You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Well, the United States created the Mujahideen. It then rebranded them as Al-Qaeda. And then it rebranded them again as ISIL or ISIS or Daesh or whatever you want to call it. But these people were being recruited by the American government. As far as the Mujahideen went, there were 52 recruiting offices in the United States, including Washington, D.C. But nobody can tell me any more about it.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Mark Crispin Miller, Lionel, J. Michael Springman, and Wayne Madsen. Today's show, 9/11 and the Transporter Jihad. On September 10th and 11th, 2016, hundreds of attorneys, researchers, and activists gathered at the historic Great Hall of Cooper Union in New York City to expose the truth and explore obtaining justice for the crimes of September 11th that continue to serve as the pretext for the global war on terror. The Justice in Focus 9/11 conference was hosted by New York University Professor of Media, Culture, and Communication, Mark Crispin Miller. Today we will hear presentations by trial lawyer and author Lionel, former Foreign Services officer and whistleblower J. Michael Springman, and investigative journalist and syndicated columnist Wayne Madsen.
There are heroes among us. We're now very lucky to be joined as a special guest speaker by Lionel. You may well know him and his work as a trial lawyer, an Emmy Award-winning, nationally syndicated American radio and TV personality, a legal analyst, essayist, lecturer, actor, author, etc. He's publicly posed very tough questions about the 9/11 attacks, which is unusual for a public figure in the media. So please join me in welcoming Lionel.
Thank you. So, did you tell your friends where you were going today? Did you tell them? They say, oh, there's that Larry. He's going to that 9/11 thing. You know how Larry is, tinfoil hat guy. By the way, we haven't worn tin in years. It's aluminum foil. Just want to clarify that for you. Let me tell you what happened to me, and we all have a story, what it was that got your attention. In my lifetime, in my generation, I went through, either as a child or old enough to understand, from the Vietnam War to a five-year period of assassinations from JFK to RFK to Martin Luther King to Malcolm X to Medgar Evers, then there's Watergate, then there's Vietnam. So I have believed absolutely nothing that was ever provided to me as remotely representing the facts by the government or the mainstream sheeple, the bumper sticker, echo chamber, cookie cutter, corporate bought and sold media, sock puppet. I don't believe anything. Nothing. Let me repeat this. Nothing. And I'm in the media. So I really am an expert witness. Let me tell you what happened to me. This was my epiphany. I speak for myself. I don't represent any group. I'm not a truther, a falser, a vaxxer, a birther, a deather. None of that. I'm me. That's it. Let me tell you my epiphany moment. Sadly, I was here that day, that beautiful Tuesday. It was gorgeous. A sky so blue, pre-geoengineering and nanoparticulates in the air. Don't get me started on that, too. That's another one. The only thing you can point to with somebody next to you and say, what's that? Oh, there you go again with the conspiracy theories. No, what is that? There you go. Amazing. So I was there and went through the horror, the surreal horror that everybody did. I was bombarded by information, bombarded by you name it. I couldn't keep track of what was being said, what was being hit, who was saying what. I didn't think cover-up, conspiracy, nothing. Who could? Who in this maelstrom, this horror, this symphony of death and the smell? It reminded you every day, that smell. It was like when an engine burns out in an old vacuum cleaner or something. It hung everywhere. It was horrible. I thought nothing. I thought, this is the way it was. I wasn't even questioning anything. And then one day I was on the radio, and somebody mentioned to me this thing called Shanksville, Flight 93. Yeah. I knew. I thought I did. I don't know. I'm still shocked. I'm not a conspiracist or any of that stuff. I'm a lawyer. I'm a trial lawyer. I was a prosecutor. I like this thing called evidence. Call me wacky. So I looked one day as somebody was calling in about Flight 93. Let's roll. Beamer, the whole bit. I can recite the story like everybody else could. I didn't doubt it. I was still trying to sift through so many stories. North Tower, South Tower, Building 7, which I didn't even know about then. The greatest mystery of them all, Flight 93 Shanksville and the Pentagon. That was that. Then there were the issues involving health and first responders and the government and drills. And I mean, who could sift through this? So there I was. I looked at my Google images, and I'm looking for this plane crash. Stupid me. They said Flight 93, Shanksville. Pfft, a plane crash. And I'm looking at Google images. Because sometimes I will kind of cut it. Do you ever try to find somebody's face? Like, what was that guy's name? Images. Oh, yeah, him. And then you go to the web. Oh, it was Larry. So I'm looking for this thing. And I'm looking. And on the air, I said, you ready for this? Brilliant. Know what I asked? Where's the plane? Thinking nothing. Stupid me. Where's the plane? Please, no Hervé Villechaize jokes, but you know, the plane, right? So I'm no expert in aeronautical crashes. I'm not a forensic pathologist. I can tell when people are dead. I'm not an OBGYN. I can tell when people are pregnant. And I can tell a plane crash. Again, call me wacky. I'm a savant. I'm gifted. You know, wheels, wings, stabilizers, people, luggage, glass, wire, smoke, gas, fill in the blank. And I asked the question, where's the plane? Phone call. Line one. What are you getting at? What am I getting at? Oh, I don't know. I'm getting at, where's the plane? Are you a conspiracy theorist? I said, I've got a question for you. What the hell are you talking about? Am I looking in the right place? That's all I want to know. Then I'm reading. Stupid me. And I'm reading in, you know, not, you know, Skippy's blog, some kid in his parents' basement, you know, with Cheeto dust and a, no, I'm reading, you know. And they bring up New Baltimore and Indian Lake, and 8 miles away, there's a debris field. I said, hey, there's a debris field 8 miles from there. Do you know what somebody said? Google this. Well, it was windy that day. 6-ton titanium engines. That's when I realized, oh, my God. It wasn't, oh, my God, that the horror. But I understood that I am an alien. And I live in this parallel universe that requires proof. And then a friend of mine called up and he said, you know, you might want to look here, 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 and here, and here. And it started. And then I'm in this. I'm thinking, what's going on here? Now, let me just cut to the chase here because I don't want to, please. Somebody give me a time cue. I'm an old stand-up comic. Give me a flashlight or something. I don't want to go over. All right. But when you're a prosecutor and you walk in, there's a homicide. There's four kinds of death. Think of this acronym, NASH. Natural, accidental, suicide, homicide. That's it. So if we walk in, hypothetically, and there's an old lady, bless her heart, handcuffed behind her back with 12 shots to the head, and somebody asks you, is that natural, accidental, suicide, or homicide? You could say, well, I don't think that's natural. I don't think that's accidental. Suicide, Houdini, may be a contortionist, perhaps, but no. No, I'm going to put my money on homicide. That's over here. There's something wrong here. Question then comes to, who did it? I don't know who did it. Why would they want to kill this woman? She was a beautiful person, a grandmother. I don't know why. So that's what I want the world to know. Please separate the incredible evidence that Richard Gage has done. And by the way, when C-SPAN finally just grew a pair and had to put you on, I thought maybe there is a God. And maybe she's fair. I don't know. But don't confuse something that indicates that the official story is wrong with who is involved in it. Because we don't know. We don't know these things. You can't tell. Now, I know people who have never in their lives ever been involved in anything involving critical thinking. This is their first rodeo. And you hear this all the time. Is this cognitive dissonance? Is this a smoking gun? Is this an inside job? Hey, Sparky, take it easy. You're reading the bumper stickers too much. If I hear cognitive dissonance one more time, I'm going to take a life. I'm going to stab somebody in the heart with a pencil. Stop the cognitive dissonance. As like people say, it's harp. Stop with the harp. What do you read this stuff from? It's an inside job. It's either the Mossad, it's Cheney with the punch. We don't know this. If somebody can tell me where to go for that, you let me go because I've been looking for this. But that's not what this is about. Here's the thing. Gore Vidal said three things about conspiracy theories, which I'll never forget. Number one, he said one day it will be an article of faith that you do not believe in conspiracy theories. Number one. Number two, conspiracy theories are code word for the unspeakable truth. And finally, my favorite. He said, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a conspiracy analyst. Now, by definition, the official story is that a number of people, 1920 hijackers, conspired, confederated, joined together to pull this off. That's a conspiracy. So, yes, this is the conspiracy theory by their very words. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in simply this. This is, I believe, a great, great country, capable of being even greater. And John Pilger said, and others, don't believe anything until it's officially denied. And you have the right, the absolute right, to ask anything you want, any time you want, for as long as you want, until you're satisfied. And it is absolutely, fundamentally, not only your right, but your duty. And you're going to meet people, and I've met people before, who are the anti-conspiracy theorists. They get jollies out of mocking, destroying, anything that anybody suggests might be an alternative version to reality as expressed by the bought and sold sock puppet Ted Baxter mainstream media. They take relish in fighting you because they don't like you. And the main reason they don't like you is they don't know anything about what you're talking about. And this would involve them reading. So what I'm saying to you today, why I am all here to celebrate this, to encourage this, I wish this place were packed. I wish students and young people will be pulled in here just say, this is what happens. We need our own Russell Commission, our own permanent committee to just ask questions. We're still trying to figure out the Civil War. I'm listening to lectures by the greatest historians now trying to decipher the Civil War. We don't even understand Vietnam. And I'm supposed to give you an answer as to everything that happened on 9/11? Not yet. Thank you for allowing me the chance to be here. Congratulations to you. Congratulations to you and all the independent scholars, independent historians, citizen journalists, and those people with an open mind and an open heart. Because this isn't their story, their history, it's our history. And our story. And we can ask it for as long as we want or as much as we want. Thank you.
That was really great. Conspiracy theory is something that if true, you couldn't handle it. Right? Isn't that what a conspiracy theory is? I have to tell a really quick story. I wrote a book about the theft of the 2004 election. It's called Fooled Again. It came out in 2005 and got reviewed nowhere and so on. It was attacked by the left, interestingly enough, and ignored by the mainstream press. So I went all over the country appearing on radio shows and so on, doing my best to spread the word about it. And I was somewhere talking about it, coming up with the, you know, evidence the election had been stolen because it's copious. And caller number one, extremely angry, extremely aggressive, and his response to what I'd said was, Mark Christopher Miller is the author of a book claiming that 9/11 was an inside job. Okay, I had never written such a book. You know, I hadn't even thought about 9/11 yet because I was my brain pan was filled with the election theft, so I couldn't really fit all that other stuff in yet. But that shows you that there is a script that is used by people who I think are hired, that are on the payroll, to discredit anyone who raises those forbidden questions. And that's what we're up against.
You're listening to presentations by Lionel, J. Michael Springman, and Wayne Madsen from the Justice in Focus 9/11 conference hosted by Mark Crispin Miller. Today's show, 9/11 and the Transporter Jihad. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, I have a little bit of housekeeping of my own to offer. If you see something, say something. Right? You guys see anything? Okay. So what we're going to do is, after introducing the panel, then we'll have a Q&A afterwards. So I'll be back to oversee that. And again, your index cards are available for you to write down your questions, and we'll put those to the panelists. So J. Michael Springman is an attorney, a former Foreign Services officer, and a whistleblower who served in the Commerce Department and a State Department diplomat with postings in Germany, India, and Saudi Arabia. In his book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, he details how he was pressured to issue visas to mercenaries for insurgencies starting in the early 80s. Right now, he practices law and was recognized in 2004 by the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee as one of its pro bono attorneys of the year. Next to him is my old friend Wayne Madsen, a Washington, D.C.-based investigative journalist. Wayne Madsen Reports is an indispensable resource, which I strongly recommend. He has 20 years' experience in security issues. As a U.S. naval officer, he managed one of the first computer security programs for the U.S. Navy. He subsequently worked for the National Security Agency. We're not going to hold that against him. The Naval Data Automation Command, Department of State, RCA Corporation, and Computer Sciences Corporation. He was a senior fellow for the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, which is a privacy public advocacy organization. He's also a member of the Society of Professional Journalists, the Association for Intelligence Officers, and the National Press Club.
Hi, I'm Mike Springman. I think you know who I am from that introduction. I've got to say that I'm really pleased and quite honored to be invited back again to talk to you folks. And I frankly enjoy myself while I'm here. I am someone who knows what he's talking about. As from the bio that you've just been given, I can walk on water and not get my shoelaces wet, I guess. I also have 2 degrees in foreign affairs, and my last assignment at the Department of State was in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research. So I know what I'm talking about. And I will try to keep to my daughter's advice to avoid jargon, terms of art, and slang that's not generally known amongst the general populace. I tend to do that, and I hope I don't do it today. But Wayne Madsen wrote a very nice review of my book, and in it he says the 28 pages is essentially what Mike Springman's book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, is all about. And he's right. And you're going to hear more about that. But let me talk about my experience and what I saw from being in Saudi Arabia with the State Department and what I got out of my research for 2 years for my book. It's the website is www.michaelspringman.com. And if you want to reach me, the email address is info@danapub.com. Now, what the United States did in the 1970s and 1980s was create a terrorist organization. It recruited the Mujahideen for the war in Afghanistan against the former Soviet Union. These were some of the worst possible people that the United States government and its repressive and reprehensible allies, such as Saudi Arabia and Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Group, could put together. Cheryl Bernard, the wife of Zabe Khalizad, the former American ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, and the United Nations, said that we couldn't get the Soviets out of Afghanistan unless we got the worst possible people we could find to do it. And that's why you have no moderates, no leftists, no progressives, no nothing except crazy men in Afghanistan. And what the United States did after Afghanistan was form these people into a cadre, an Arab-Afghan legion, if you will, the people who were recruited from all over the Arab world and elsewhere, Indonesia and the Philippines, for example, to go and destabilize governments the United States didn't like, such as Yugoslavia, a socialist government that did not cooperate with America. It destroyed Iraq because Saddam Hussein was a secularist who didn't like religious fanatics in his government and didn't take direction from Washington. It did the same to Libya with Muammar Gaddafi. His country had the highest standard of living by UN measurements in Africa. And he went by because he was trying to control terrorists, and he would put them in jail or send them back to whatever country they came from. Same thing is happening today in Syria. Bashar al-Assad is a secularist. He has a government of many confessions, Christian, Shi'i, Sunni, and various other religions, and such as Druze. And he isn't cooperating with Washington, so he has to be removed. Now, how did this start? Very simply. I was in at the beginning in Jeddah in the late 1980s. And before I left Washington, the then American ambassador to Saudi Arabia had me in to meet him. And I figured it was going to be a 5-minute hello and goodbye session. And after that, I would go my merry way and go back to area studies or something like this. Well, Cutler spent 45 minutes telling me about all the problems my predecessor, Greta Holtz, had created for the American Embassy in Riyadh. And he kept saying, well, she wasn't giving visas to rich Saudi women servants, and rich Saudi women can't travel to the United States unless they have hairdressers and seamstresses and other factotums to help them do it. I thought, this guy is telling me something, but I have absolutely no idea what he's telling me. But from what he's saying about my predecessor, she's going to make my career in the State Department. Well, after this was over, I talked to the economic officer from the Saudi desk, essentially the part of the State Department that follows affairs in Saudi Arabia and interprets what's going on in the country to the rest of the department. I said to him, what was that all about? And the guy said, I don't know. Walter Cutler is just a queer duck. Well, I got to Jeddah, and suddenly there was all this pressure to issue visas to people who had no ties either to the United States or to their own countries that would compel them to return from the United States after a visit. And I said, no, you can't go to America. We had a guy, for example, who was going to a trade show organized by the U.S. Department of Commerce, and he couldn't name the trade show, and he had no idea what city it was located in or where it was going to be held. And Paul Arbitrate, a few minutes later, the clandestine service officer concealed in the commercial section called me up and said, I want a visa for this guy. And I said, no. And another hour after that, he called the chief of the section and got my decision reversed. And you can't do that. It's against the law and against State Department regulations. If someone wants to overrule a consular officer's decision, he has to have information that was not available to the consular officer when he made the denial. And he has to show it to the consular officer, and it has to be so persuasive that the guy can overrule himself. But no, it was done, taken out of my hands. It was given to Justice Stevens, his given name, to overrule me and give these guys visas. And this went on for a year and a half. It was people that couldn't have the slightest idea where they were going. I had one guy come in, and he was going to the United States. And I said, well, which city? And he looks around the waiting room. And we had pictures on the wall of Detroit and San Francisco and New York. And he said, oh, I'm going to Detroit. And I said, no, you're not. But this went on. It got to the point where people would come to me with a stack of passports and say, you can issue the visas now, or I'll go to the Consul General, Jay Frères, and we'll have you overruled, and you can issue the visas then. And it was absolutely amazing. I complained to the head of the consular section, Justice Stevens. I complained to Stephanie Smith, the counselor for consular affairs in the capital, Riyadh, at the embassy. She advised me to go to Washington and complain to the Bureau of Consular Affairs, which I did. And nobody wanted to talk to me. Nobody cared. And I said, this is really strange, because this is clearly visa fraud of some kind or another, and I don't know whether somebody's being paid off or what. And I had tried to get a handle on what was going on before I went out to Jeddah by writing my predecessor, Greta Holtz. I sent her three letters saying, what's it like? What did you wish you had known before you got to Jeddah and so forth? And never got a reply. And she came up to Jeddah from her next assignment, Sana'a in Yemen, and she told me, well, I was just too overwhelmed and too pressured and too uncomfortable to give you a real answer, which lasted for all of 15 minutes. I said, she's hiding something. Well, Greta, who is such a problem child, is now American ambassador to Oman after being a deputy assistant secretary of state in Washington, D.C. So this was a really strange thing, and I was eventually tossed out of the State Department, and I could never find out why. I said I wanted to find out under the Freedom of Information Act twice. The first time it went to a lawsuit, and it was sealed as a threat to national security. The second time, Reggie Walton, the judge in Washington, he was also on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, he simply shut the thing down saying, you haven't exhausted all of your remedies, which I had, in fact, done. So what was all this about? Well, I ran into Joe Trento, a journalist, while doing some research in an article I was trying to write. And Joe told me that, well, basically what they were doing was recruiting for the Mujahideen. The CIA and the State Department were working with Osama bin Laden to get people from all over the Arab world, all over the Muslim world, and bring them to Washington for training and debriefings and whatever, and then send them on to Afghanistan to kill Soviet soldiers, blow things up and shoot things down, hopefully with Ivan inside. Well, that explained everything. And I said, my God. And as time went by, I kept writing articles, I kept speaking out, I was invited to various organizations to talk to them about what went on in Jeddah, and got nowhere. And after the second Freedom of Information Act request was shot down, I decided I'd write the book. And I drew on my experience, 2 years' worth of research that I conducted, plus interviews with knowledgeable people, to put this together and to say, well, the United States created the Mujahideen. It then rebranded them as Al-Qaeda. And then it rebranded them again as ISIL or ISIS or Daesh or whatever you want to call it. But these people were being recruited by the American government. As far as the Mujahideen went, there were 52 recruiting offices in the United States, including Washington, D.C. But nobody can tell me any more about it. I go to officials in the government and say, hey, talk to me. I mean, it's been 25 years now. Aren't you a little bit uncomfortable about what's happened? Did you see this at the beginning when you started doing this? Dead silence. I mean, I dealt with the people in Jeddah. I wrote Greta Holtz, no response. I wrote Henry Encher, who works for the Central Intelligence Agency and was rewarded by an ambassadorship to Algeria. I contacted other people, the head of the CIA station, Eric Quackenbush. Dead silence. Nobody wants to talk to me. But I laid it all out in the book. I name names. In fact, one journalist in Washington said it's a dangerous book because it names names. And I show who was involved, how it was done, and where these people are now, and as best I could find out. And the book is selling. The CIA hasn't been to my door like Wayne Mattson. I do have problems with an awful lot of spam on my email and on my telephone. But so far I'm not in jail, and nobody's wrestled me to the ground and tasered me, so I figure I'm ahead of the game. So I think my time is just about up. They're going to haul me off the stage with a hook, and if I don't do it and shut up and go on and let Wayne talk, they won't invite me back again. So I've enjoyed the privilege of speaking to you. You've been a great audience. You actually laughed at some of the things I said. So thank you kindly, and I hope to see you again. And let's go forward and make these people accountable for what they do. Thank you.
You are listening to presentations by Lionel, J. Michael Springman, and Wayne Madsen from the Justice in Focus 9/11 conference hosted by Mark Crispin Miller. Today's show, 9/11 and the Transporter Jihad. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Well, it's good to be back speaking at Cooper Union. I spoke here on the fifth anniversary of 9/11 in 2006. It's also an honor to be speaking on the same stage where Abraham Lincoln spoke in 1860. So my speech, we'll start with 47 years. Oh, no, wait a minute. That's his speech. I'll stick with my speech. The Islamic State. Where did this thing come from? You know, after 9/11, Bush and Cheney and the rest of that cabal told us, give us some of your privacy. We're going to institute this Patriot Act so we'll never have to face another major terrorist attack in the United States. We all agreed, reluctantly, many of us had to go along with it because our representatives voted for it. There was never any hearings on it. Now tell people in Orlando, San Bernardino, Fort Hood, and other places, how did that work out for you, giving up all those constitutional rights and to be promised increased security. It didn't happen. And what I'm going to suggest to you is the reason it didn't happen was because when Al-Qaeda's shelf life expired, they said, we need to rebrand it. And how did they rebrand it? They rebranded it with this Islamic State. Now, you hear Obama, he talks about it. He says ISIL. Others in the administration say ISIS. John Kerry likes Daesh because he's, you know, he speaks French. But ISIS is a creation of various intelligence services, including our own. And the chickens have come home to roost. It started out with Al-Qaeda in Iraq. It was amazing. The Democratic nominee for president of the United States just the other day stated over here on the Intrepid, on the Hudson, she said, there was Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was in Iraq. Not when Saddam Hussein was the president of Iraq. He was one of their worst enemies. Al-Qaeda began in Iraq when we invaded and occupied the country. And what we saw develop in Iraq was a guy named Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a.k.a. Ahmed Fadil Nizal al-Khalaya, Jordanian national, we were told. He was the head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, except many people said, including the spokesperson for the U.S. Central Command, they said, this guy Zarqawi's a fake. We developed him. He's a fictional character. It didn't end there. So they said they killed Zarqawi. And we saw a body, just like with bin Laden, of course. Then we had Abu Omar al-Baghdadi. And now this guy became the second leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. He didn't last too long either. Especially after one of bin Laden's people said, he too is a creation. There is no such person as Omar al-Baghdadi. So then they had to get rid of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And these guerrillas went over into Syria after this administration decided to destabilize the only remaining secular governments in the Middle East, in Libya, in Syria, in Yemen, and in Egypt. And what we had was a civil war in Syria. The remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq poured over into the Syrian, over the Syrian border. And we had Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, another, this is Baghdadi number two. And again, we had revelations that this al-Baghdadi is a fake, which John McCain would like because he's seen in a photograph with the purported head of the Islamic State when he snuck across from Turkey into Iraq. But these are all fictional characters. So what is the Islamic State? Well, what the Islamic State is, it's a creation. And who were the midwives for it? Well, General David Petraeus, the disgraced former commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, Even after he was in Iraq, he was supposedly fighting Al-Qaeda. And when it came to Syria, it was at the CIA. He said we should have an alliance with Al-Qaeda against ISIS. What in the world is this man talking about? ISIS came out of Al-Qaeda. He was supposed to be defeating Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and he says, no, we need to have an alliance with Al-Qaeda. Now, what kind of message does that send to all the people who lost loved ones in this country because we were told Al-Qaeda did it? So now it's like 1984 with Orwell. Al-Qaeda's not our enemy. ISIS is our enemy. We've always been in an alliance with Al-Qaeda. You know, just that same Orwellian talk. The other midwife, Hillary Clinton, as I mentioned, destabilizing secular pan-Arab socialist governments, even though many of them had transitioned away from socialism. What replaced them? The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and Al-Qaeda ran rampant through Libya and through Syria and through Yemen. Barack Obama, he decides the person he's going to go to get advice on how the United States should proceed with its Middle East policies is Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the Turkish president, who thinks he's the new sultan of the neo-Ottoman Empire. It was Erdogan who was giving the breathing space and logistical support to ISIS in Syria, even was marketing their oil, and his son benefited from that financially, on the international market. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, well, say no more about them. I think the 28 pages speak for themselves about what the Saudi role has been, not only with al-Qaeda, but now with the Islamic State. They have been supporting these jihadist radicals in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Yemen. Israel, just recently, the Begin Sadat Center in Israel said, oh, we got to keep ISIS around. It's good for us to help defeat the Moscow-Tehran-Damascus axis. You know, I thought that axis of evil went away with the Bush administration, but apparently it's still alive and doing well in Israeli think tanks. They said, yeah, we need ISIS around. It served as a very good partner in getting rid of Gaddafi in Libya and going after Assad in Syria and launching the Sunni insurgency in Iraq, which targeted the Shia-dominated government of that country. And then there's good old Chancellor Merkel of Germany. She says to all these refugees that are pouring out of Syria, some of which were young men who had iPhones, debit cards. Now, where did they get this? These are not your normal run-of-the-mill refugees. She says, oh, come on in. Yeah, and they come in. And now it's not safe to walk the streets in many German towns and cities. The same situation in France. And, again, she deserves a lot of condemnation for helping Islamic State, some of whom went from Europe to Syria and then were allowed back into Europe. And ISIS's deep-pocketed benefactor, the guy who came up with this R2P nonsense, responsibility to protect. Actually, it was the irresponsibility to overthrow secular governments. And, you know, this guy's money goes far and wide, George Soros. And he said, the EU has to accept at least 1 million asylum seekers annually for the foreseeable future. Well, who elected this guy dictator? But unfortunately, people like Merkel and Hollande in France listened to him. And really, unfortunately, many people in our own government listened to him. This man should be not listened to. He has helped destabilize with his support for the Arab Spring and now the invasion of Europe by migrants, many of whom are jihadists. He's the guy that bears a lot of responsibility for this mess. And there's, of course, other enablers of what I would call the trans-border jihad. Ukrainian president, a puppet, I should say, Petro Poroshenko, now has ISIS brigades fighting alongside Ukrainian militia, including some neo-Nazi groups, against Russian-speaking individuals in eastern Ukraine. And the guy you probably haven't heard of is the UN Special Representative for the Secretary General for International Migration, Peter Sutherland. This is the guy who's really pushing to take in more migrants, not just from Syria, from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from North Africa, other countries that have been destabilized where this jihadism is running rampant. Jihadism, as I suggest, already was manufactured by groups nurtured by the United States and other intelligence services. Peter Sutherland is the guy pushing for this, along with Soros. He's former head of Goldman Sachs International, to put him in proper perspective. Now, I think the idea to hold people accountable through tribunals is a good idea, and my attempt is to show where some of the subpoenas can be taken and delivered to some of the perpetrators who continue to perpetrate violence against not only Americans, but innocent people in Europe, in Africa. We hear a lot about the attacks in Europe. We don't hear much about the attacks on hotels in Ouagadougou and Burkina Faso and Bamako and Mali and other cities in West Africa. You know, and I blame the corporate media for that. If it happens in Africa, like, who cares? There's also been attacks in Thailand and Bangladesh, and other developing countries around the world. So this is a worldwide effort. I applaud what the judge said earlier. This is an outgrowth of the strategy of tensions. And it's not just the United States that suffers. It's countries around the world. I just want to leave you with that. I have a new book coming out at the end of the month. It's called The Almost Classified Guide to CIA Front Companies, Proprietaries, and Contractors. But that even shocked me when I started to look at how many of these were in existence since the CIA's inception in 1947. I think we can start by cleaning up our act. We got to get rid of that agency. The CIA has long since outlived its purpose and usefulness. As President Kennedy said, that agency needs to be torn up into 1,000 pieces and thrown into the wind. I disagree with the late Senator Moynihan from New York. He said, let's just downsize it and put it into the State Department as an intelligence collecting agency. My answer to that idea is don't mend it, end it. Thank you.
You're listening to presentations by Lionel, J. Michael Springman, and Wayne Madsen from the Justice in Focus 9/11 conference hosted by Mark Crispin Miller. Today's show, 9/11 and the Transporter Jihad. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
All righty. So I will ask a question, two questions. It's kind of the same question, and you know, maybe the answer is self-evident, but I guess it's useful for me to pose this question because it will foreground some of the implications of what you've all said. Concerning the creation of the Mujahideen et Alia, okay? Is it the case that, okay, you may recall Zbigniew Brzezinski gave a famous interview to Nouvelle Observateur where he boasted of the fact that the United States government, basically bled the Soviet Union to death by creating the Mujahideen and sending them to the border with Afghanistan, the Russian border, deliberately to draw Russia into Afghanistan so that actually the invasion of Afghanistan was a defensive response to, you know, covert U.S. aggression, right?
Russia's Vietnam.
He boasted of this. And what little coverage this received was cast in the following way, that this was a reckless move by the U.S. without any consideration of the possible blowback from this eventually, right? So on the basis of that paradigm, I ask, you know, is it the case of our chickens coming home to roost that terrible things have happened as a result of this short-sighted policy, or with the judge's talk in mind and Operation Gladio in mind, is it the case that these horrific consequences were actually intentional? Okay, that's the first version of the question. And now, were the 19 hijackers put up to it by Saudi Arabia so that the, you know, kind of virulent coverage by the tabloid press is perfectly justified, royal scum and so on? Or were they patsies who, were sort of handled and organized and placed sort of the way Lee Harvey Oswald was in 1963? Okay? Do you see that they're kind of the same question, but it's the difference between a kind of incompetence or something much worse. So I guess, Michael and Wayne, if you'd like to answer the first one, either one of you.
Yeah, okay, that works. I would be inclined to say it's a little bit of both. Brzezinski made the point in the talking to the French paper that, well, what's more important, the end of the Soviet Union or some stirred up Muslims?
Right.
But Joe Trento, in his book, America and the Islamic Bomb, talked about the plans to do this, that they were going to sow dish in the Soviet Union's backyard. They were going to, the Americans were going to manufacture it and give it to the Mujahideen who were going to sow it, and it would be the Soviets would have to deal with it. And I think that's part of it. And I think they couldn't really see all the consequences from this. But I think from my research on the book here, Visas for Al-Qaeda, I came to the conclusion that somewhere along the way, in the middle of the Afghan war against the Soviets, that the Americans themselves said, hey, we've got guys who are well-trained in shooting things down and blowing things up. They can do anything they want. Why don't we use them for something? And they don't necessarily, it's not as organized as the Marine Corps, for example. It's not as well-directed as the Marine Corps. But at the same time, you've got this group that are willing to go anywhere, anytime the United States needs to have a government overthrown or a country destabilized. And you see it happening in Venezuela. Maybe the Arab Afghans aren't there. But there are some characters there that want to get the end of the Chavez and Maduro revolution into the grave. In Kiev, in the Ukraine, you had the same thing. You had another one of Wayne Madsen's color-coded revolutions. So I think a lot of this is planned, and they don't necessarily care about the consequences.
Okay. Wayne, want to address this?
Well, one of the things, I spent a lot of time at the National Archives, not the one in town where the Declaration of Independence is, but the something called the Steny Hoyer Reading Room, which should be actually the restroom up there should be named the Steny Hoyer Reading Room. But, yeah, this new thing about people who are still alive naming things after themselves, where did that start? I've run across CIA documents now declassified. There's a 25-year, we're now right into the period stuff is being declassified towards the end of the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan, 1989, 1990. It's quite interesting that there were certain people in the CIA who said, let's not stop with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. We'll get rid of that government, which, by the way, under the government in Afghanistan, which was a socialist government, women were treated as equals right. to men. You know, oh, that's, my God, we can't have that, right, in Afghanistan. But there were active measures by the CIA to bring the war not only to the border, but across the border and stirring up the Muslims in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and also in the Caucasus region with Chechnya. And so when the Soviet Union fell, where did the initial problem start in post-Soviet Russia, places like Chechnya? And you look at some of the key people in the CIA that was advancing this, you find people like Graham Fuller, for example. Graham Fuller was Bill Casey's number one advisor on Muslim countries and that part of the world, from Afghanistan all the way over to the Black Sea. And, of course, why is that interesting? Because when we had the Boston Marathon bombing, Tamerlan and Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, their uncle was Uncle Tsarny, but it was Tsarnaev, and he had been married to Graham Fuller's daughter.
Right.
I mean, this is like Hinckley's a good friend of the Bush family. How much does it take to convince somebody that these are links that need to be explored more fully, and certainly that wasn't pursued, but the roots to this go back to that Fuller, Casey, Gates. Bob Gates at the CIA, because they wanted to say we can use the Muslims, not only in Afghanistan, but inside the Soviet Union to bring down the Soviet government. And they absolutely started to provide a training to them. And now we see Uzbek legions in Syria and Iraq. We see Chechen legions. So, yeah, you talk chickens coming home to roost. But we get the thing, yeah, well, Putin is a terrible dictator. Well, it's the same idea like we used against the Afghan government at the time, the secular socialist government. These people, and Brzezinski. Look, the one thing about Brzezinski we have to remember is he's a Polish Catholic nationalist who hates Russians. And when you understand that, you understand where Brzezinski's coming from.
Right.
And to give, and NBC giving his daughter
you know, a goofy variety show in the morning with that intern killer, Joe Scarborough. It defies logic.
Well, I mean, this being a symposium on 9/11, right? I mean, which a horror that took place right here in town. It's probably fair to ask if it isn't just way over there that this kind of thing may be intentionally done. You mentioned the Boston Marathon bombing. I mean, there are questions about reasonable questions, not wild-eyed conspiracy theory paranoid imaginings, but reasonable questions about San Bernardino, about Orlando, about Nice, where the French government is actually trying to suppress the video evidence of that truck attack, which we're told slaughtered all these people. But, you know, even officials in that government are raising questions about this attempted suppression. Just by observing, especially since, you know, given what we've been hearing since this morning, it is, to me, all that much more staggering how much of what most of us have believed is simply based on the mere say-so of the government filtered through the New York Times and others. It is amazing because we pride ourselves on not having a state-controlled press, and yet all the empirical evidence seems to suggest that we do have something a lot like one.
Listening to Mark Crispin Miller, Lionel, J. Michael Springman, and Wayne Madsen from the Justice in Focus 9/11 conference in New York City, September 10th and 11th. Today's show has been 9/11 and the Transporter Jihad. For more information about the conference and its speakers, visit 911justiceinfocus.com. That's 911justiceinfocus.com. Visit markcrispinmiller.com. Visit lionelmedia.com. Visit michaelspringman.com. Visit WayneMadsenReport.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yarrow Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at GunsAndButter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@GunsAndButter.org. Follow us on Twitter at G&B Radio.
Hey, yo. And a new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? So wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look what's inside yourself for peace.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Two activist lawyers, Ralph Nader and Bruce Fine, spoke on the government's violation of the Constitution, spoke at Harvard Law School on February 8. I found Nader's speech especially compelling. In fact, this was the hardest-hitting speech by Nader I've ever heard. It's a damning indictment of the Obama and Bush administrations alike, and it's a plea to law students to discover their power and moral authority, and to use them to defend the Constitution and promote justice. Apparently, Nader's audience was mostly first-year law students. 1Ls, they call them at Harvard. Apparently, the third-year students were off practicing for that interview with Goldman Sachs. And the faculty was busy writing Obama memos arguing that unprovoked bombing of another country, murdering civilians, and torture do not violate the Geneva Conventions or U.S. law. Well, the Harvard 1Ls got quite an earful from a guy who was a Harvard 1L himself back in 1956. Here's Ralph Nader.
Second, is there anybody from the faculty here? Okay. Third, are there any notables in the administrative hierarchy of the Harvard Law School here who keep the institution going? Okay. How many here are 1L, please? How many are 2L? How many are 3L? Precisely as predicted. That's what the law school does to you. You come in idealistic. You actually think the law has some connection with the word justice, which Senator Daniel Webster once called the great work of human beings on earth. And by the time you're finished, if you're not exhausted, you're heading into mostly these corporate law firms who are the power brokers for a great deal of the criminality and the Wall Street shenanigans that have been going on. They are the brilliant geniuses of facilitating the subjugation of the law by raw corporate power, all in the name of the law. Now, we are members of a profession that have historically continued to lie to ourselves. Most professions lie to themselves. A lot of doctors don't think there's much malpractice, for example. And lying to ourselves estranges ourselves from reality. So we live in illusion. We live in illusion that was expressed in September when John Brennan came here. How many of you were in the room when John Brennan was there? See, very few. And he arrived here, and he gave a speech. Now, John Brennan is the assistant to President Barack Obama for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. And he gave a speech entitled, "Strengthening Our Security by Adhering to Our Values and Laws," end quote. He dared to come to the Harvard Law School and present a rendition of very nice-sounding values which were almost entirely fictional in terms of what the White House has been doing. Just the opposite. And Harvard Law School didn't lay a glove on him. And he got away with it. And he got away with it because his audience was fawning, largely fawning over him. It was not this audience. If you want to read it, it's online, and you will see that he makes a remarkable series of statements. First, our highest priority, Mr. Brennan said, is and will always be the safety and security of the American people. As President Obama has said, we have no greater responsibility as a government. Who defines security and safety? Those who cause most of its transgressions. The styles of violence that are described in our country and given highest priority are those that are not responsible to corporate power. They are not traced to corporate power. And so while 3,000 people were massacred on 9/11, which generated a massive counterterrorism business with trillions of dollars in war and armaments and domestic security activities and jobs and consultings and think tanks and equipment. And it was all to keep America safe. Here's what was going on. Every year, 45,000 people dead every year, according to Harvard Medical School researchers, because they don't have health insurance, they can't afford it, to get diagnosed and treated. Every year, 58,000 Americans die from workplace-related diseases, according to OSHA, and trauma. Every year, 65,000 Americans die, according to the EPA, from preventable pollution. Every year, 100,000 Americans die every year due to hospital malpractice, not counting emergency rooms. Harvard School of Public Health study. In other words, there are well over 300,000 Americans who die from preventable causes and certainly should reside under the definition of national security that aren't even part of a single dialogue in any political campaigns of the major parties. They are not the preoccupation of Barack Obama, who has spent more time figuring out how to kill a suspected terrorist overseas in his briefings every morning than he has spent on all of these preventable American deaths, including far larger numbers of sick and injured people who are directly under his authority and responsibility to do something about it. And yet, right after 9/11, the world was on our side. Even our adversaries sent statements of commiseration. And instead of pursuing the backers, the attackers, as a police criminal action, we decided to blow apart two countries and attack other countries, Afghanistan and Iraq, one of the greatest war crimes in American history. And in so doing, we began to immolate our own constitutional rights. Obama said a few days ago in the State of the Union that for the first time in 20 years, Osama bin Laden will not present a threat to the United States. His job was finished a long time ago. He put into motion forces fortified by greed, power, profit, sense of domination, where we're doing it to ourselves. Think of the huge diversions of public budgets to the military and to the so-called war on terrorism that could have been used for child health care, for the renovation of public works, for the protection of the environment, for the advancement of decent education, for the abolition of poverty. We're doing it to ourselves. His work is done. We are two major terrorist strikes away from a police state, the likes of which you will never be able to imagine. Look what one terrorist strike did to us, and we began doing it to ourselves. The problem with law students today is they don't have a high enough estimate of their own significance. Yes, they're often viewed in the literature as confident and boastful a little bit about their intellect, and very aggressive, and very self-motivated. But what they don't understand is that they're preparing themselves to be spokes in gigantic corporate and governmental wheels. Spokes. Well paid. What they don't understand about themselves is their own power, which I'll get to in a moment. The American Bar Association in 2005-2006, led by Michael Greco, who's a corporate lawyer downtown in Boston, issued three white papers, one of which Bruce worked on, claiming that the president then, George W. Bush, was engaging in unconstitutional behavior. Not an episode, not a single event, systemic unconstitutional behavior. Illegal surveillance, violation of the FISA Act, that's a five-year jail term. It's clearly an impeachable offense. Systemic signing statements, they thought was an unconstitutional pattern of behavior. He engaged in more signing statements than all the presidents, I think, put together before him. Now, when the ABA, which is the largest bar association in the world, known for its conservatism, can present the President of the United States with three white papers claiming that he's been engaging in consistent, unconstitutional behavior, and not get a single courtesy letter back acknowledging receipt, never mind interacting through the Office of Special Counsel or the Attorney General, you can see that what has happened in the last 10 years is an institutionalization of constitutional criminality from the violation of the congressional power to declare war to federal statutes to international treaties to Geneva Convention to national sovereignties abroad. Those three reports hardly made a ripple on law schools. We have over 180 law schools in the country. What are they there for? When I was a law student, 1L, we sat in the courtroom there, which we would be there for the speech, but I understand there's a commercial bar, Cram Course, that has taken a residence there. By the way, don't ever pick your courses based on your bar exam fears. The bar exam is eminently crammable in more ways than one. So don't say I'm not going to take jurisprudence because of the bar course. Robert Hutchins. Hutchins, as you know, I don't know, maybe you don't know, he was dean of Yale Law School at age 29. He was president of the University of Chicago. He came to Harvard to speak to us. And he asked the question, what is the purpose of the Harvard Law School? Everybody sort of snickered. And laughed, you know. What the heck kind of question is that? Doesn't he know that the Harvard Law School only has two purposes? It's to establish a very smart faculty, the best and the brightest. If you don't believe it, all you have to do is ask him. And to matriculate a very motivated student body? It doesn't have a collective voice. Didn't he understand that? Well, he was dean of Yale Law School, no wonder. He was dismissed. We now have a president, and his predecessor the same, who has arrogated to himself the role of prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner. That is something that might diminish whatever trivial occupations by comparison are involving the faculty and the law students of America. The rationalization of illegality is endless. If there was a dictionary of antonyms to the word infinity, one of the examples would be the ability of members of the legal profession to rationalize illegality from A to Z. The rationalization of illegality sometimes is abrupt and sporadic and challengeable, Joe McCarthy. But when the rationalization of illegality, when the allowance of the corporate state and the military-industrial complex, the former was warned by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the corporate state called it fascism, 1938 in a dispatch to Congress. And the latter was warned by President Eisenhower, in no uncertain terms, the military-industrial complex. When it goes on year after year, it becomes institutionalized. And when criminality becomes so institutionalized, it hardly is a subject for topics by law reviews. That's the way things are. Secret law, secret evidence, no charges, imprisonment without charges, without lawyers, indefinite. This is America. This has to be dealt with instrumentally. We are banking revenge overseas. Before the 13th drone strike killed a suspected Pakistani terrorist a few months ago, a dozen drone strikes killed over 200 people, innocent, in search of him. The banking of revenge sometimes takes a long time to exhibit itself. After all, we supported vicious dictatorships in those areas of the world, repressing their people with our military arms, our diplomatic cover, our vetoes in the UN. And it took a long time for them to say, we're going to strike the U.S. at its homeland. Banking revenge, you will see in your lifetime. And if it isn't physical armaments, it will be biological and chemical. Our country is so vulnerable, it could go down as the most vulnerable country in the world. Subways, pipelines, dams, laboratories, waste deposit sites, radioactive material. We're sitting ducks. The great mistake the public made was that after 9/11, when it was clear that this criminal gang did not have a second strike capability, that's when the war on terrorism was created. And when President Bush said there are Al-Qaeda cells, sleeper cells all over the country, they're well-funded, they hate us, they're suicidal, why didn't they strike? We were defenseless, as we are defenseless to any suicidal attack. Because they weren't there. And see, we took a criminal gang and turned it into a major war and an announcement that we would go anywhere, into any country, unilaterally, and wreck our violent will without observing our own constitution and statutes. Now, I'm going to end by just reading the list of violations that have occurred as a result of 9/11. You can have copies of this. It was put together by a great law professor who's too good to teach at Harvard, Professor Jonathan Turley at GW Law School. Professor Jonathan Turley, also a litigator, great defender of the aggrieved, said, in the decades since September 11, 2001, this country has comprehensively reduced civil liberties in the name of expanded security state. They form a mosaic of powers under which our country could be considered, at least in part, authoritarian. And this will take 1 minute. And here are his 10 losses of freedom directly attributed to the reaction of our government and its supporters after 9/11. Assassination of U.S. citizens. Indefinite detention. 3, arbitrary justice. The president now decides whether a person will receive a trial in the federal courts or in a military tribunal, a system that has been ridiculed around the world for lacking basic due process protections. 4, warrantless searches. 5, secret evidence. 6, war crimes. And that, of course, involves such things as immunizing CIA employees from being investigated or prosecuted for such actions. Secret courts. Immunity from judicial review, that's spreading. Continual monitoring of citizens, and 10 extraordinary renditions, which belies President Obama's statement that his administration will no longer torture. It's just subcontracted, that's all. Those are the 10. You can come up and get them if you'd like. Let me end with a brief sermon about law students. The trouble with you is that you're behaving as if Harvard Law School is a trade school. High-priced, highfalutin. The difference between a profession and a trade is a profession is ministered to prevent exactly the problem that it is skilled to treat for a retainer. So doctors should be preventing disease and trauma, even though they make money when they have to deal with them. Lawyers should be preventing conflict. We had a great opportunity after 9/11 to wage peace together with a police action enforcement. To wage peace. But the powers that be who realize this have not stepped forward with the requisite moral courage. After the drumbeats to the war in Iraq, where 1 million Iraqis have died at least, we don't even count them anymore, 300 former retired military officers with generals and admirals, and Admiral Shanahan, General Zinni, 300 military officers retired, diplomatic officials retired, and national security retired, spoke out publicly against the invasion of Iraq. The people who could have supported them into a major infrastructure and quadrupled their number in a month to stop this invasion, and that included George Soros, who wrote and spoke against the Iraq war, didn't have the imagination to put a couple hundred million dollars of media and staff behind that in the months before the invasion of Iraq, which could have exposed the lies and the cover-ups and the falsifications of Dick Cheney and George W. Bush, permitted by a compliant media and an ink blot Congress. Could have stopped it in its tracks, a couple hundred million dollars. He makes that in a month. Our leaders to be are you. And you've got to have a higher estimate of your role. Someone once asked me, how many women were in your class, Mr. Nader? 13. How many blacks? Maybe 2. How many Hispanics? Maybe 1. At Harvard, most of the Hispanics were children of Latin American dictators and oligarchs. And so your predecessors fought against the war in Vietnam. They fought for civil rights, sometimes being beaten up and imprisoned in the South. They fought and made the environment a major issue with Earth Day, 1970. They fought to give you not just diversity, but to give you diversity with a purpose. What's the purpose of the diversity other than career gratification? When Mr. Obama was running for president, and I criticized him, and people said, how can you criticize me? You're the first black American. I said, I just want to make sure, I want to try to make sure that it's not just an upwardly mobile career move. It's got to mean something. You speak with moral authority to working lawyers and faculty and judges. You may not know that. But when in the past law students have put out petitions and proclamations, the rest of the profession knew that those were heartfelt expressions of idealism. They knew that the law students did not have a commercial retainer to motivate them. They knew that the law students did not have an axe to grind. And that's why they knew the law students had moral authority. And you can communicate with tens of thousands of law students over the internet free, which we couldn't back then. And you can mount a movement to restore constitutional practices and the greatest idea of Western civilization, which is due process. Go for it. Thank you.
For Mr. Nader, do you have in mind any like strategies that people could use, given that there is so much concentrated power that happens to be entrenched?
The strategies to focus on Congress. The other point that's key is the moral authority of law students bleeds on the moral authority of the faculty. You get more and more people from the law schools standing up. You are the sentinels, aren't you? You're the first responders for the rule of law. It'll begin rolling forward into other areas and other professions. There are a lot of retired military and intelligence and diplomatic people who are sick to their stomach as to what they're seeing in the last 10 years. It's too bad Tony Schaefer was not here. He saw the massacres. He was there when he said to the fighter planes, don't hit that building, it's a madrasa. And the missile hit the building and slaughtered everybody in it, the school. And so once the groundswell builds up, you'll see a lot of establishment figures who are retired and free to talk, and whose patriotism is never going to be impeached by these draft-dodging neocons in Washington. They will begin swelling. This can all happen very rapidly, and of course that'll get more media.
A poll of Americans showed that 80% of Americans support the killing of Al-Awlaki and support our drone war, including 55% of self-identified liberals. So my question to you guys is, cheer me up. I mean, basically, like, what are we to do with that?
One of the great elements of due process is called cross-examination. And there was never any argument publicly reaching all these people polled as to why they should have another opinion. So obviously, if a prosecutor comes into a courtroom and with all the evidence, there's no counter evidence, and there's no appeal to the rule of law and due process, they would come out that way. Take a look at the other polls where people do have some knowledge and experience. 82% of the American people think the country's going in the wrong direction. 75% of the American people think corporations have too much control over their lives. 62% of the American people believe the two major parties are failing them. So you see, that comes from a background of a little knowledge and experience in the marketplace and so on.
Why not look at the whole class structure? This is a system of capitalism, a government of the rich, by rich, and for the rich. There's two classes, working class and the ruling class. Since 1960, I've been a socialist. I'm for the working class, having a working class government and taking over the capitalist government, which is their government, not our government. Their democracy, we need workers' democracy.
Well, you see my references in my prior remarks alluded to a lot of that. It's all a seamless web, isn't it? It all connects together. Concentration of power radiates in all directions. The abuses that attend it radiate. The more unaccountable they are, the more devastating the consequences. And so we're seeing declining livelihoods for 80% of the American people in real terms since 1973, unemployment and poverty and child poverty and so forth. So anybody who says we don't have class warfare from the top down is not...
No, in fact, James Madison in Federalist 10 describes the most prominent source of factions as unequal distributions of property, so it's not a novel idea.
That's Bruce Fine, Nader's younger colleague and podium mate, cutting Nader off at the end. A rip-roaring speech by Ralph Nader at Harvard Law School on February 8. Nader raked Bush and, even more so, Obama over the coals for their clearly impeachable crimes against the Constitution and against us, the people of the United States of America. Unfortunately, impeachment of the president is performed only by Congress, and Congress and Obama and Bush and the Supreme Court clearly are part of the same criminal gang. Nader does end on a positive note. He exhorts the law students to stand up like they used to, urges them to be first responders in defending the Constitution and the cause of justice. Nader's talk show he well knows how corrupt the system has become, yet there's that vein of optimism that he has never lost. Maybe that's some Lebanese ethnic quirk, I don't know. I wish I could tap into that vein and borrow a pint. Nader's comments were taken from the video by Harvard Law School and gently edited by me. New World Notes comes to you from WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. Please check out newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimae non carborundum, in flagrante delicto, habeas corpus, and ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. I'm joined on the show today by Dr. Graham McQueen. Graham McQueen was the founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University, where he taught for 30 years. He is co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. McQueen holds a PhD in Buddhist Studies from Harvard University. He's the author of the book, The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, which came out in 2014, and he was one of the organizers of the Toronto hearings in 2011. And he's a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel. And he joins me today to discuss an article he recently published on some recent polls taken in the United Kingdom. Graham McQueen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's always great to talk to you.
Yes, and you recently published an article on the great website globalresearch.ca called 9/11 Truth, British Muslims Overwhelmingly Reject the Official 9/11 Story. Could you tell us who put on that poll, a little bit about it?
Sure. The poll itself was published just this last December 2016, and I kind of chanced upon it when I was doing research for a different article. So I read it and was quite fascinated both by the poll results and by the way the poll was interpreted. So that's why I wrote the article. The group that sponsored the poll is called Policy Exchange. It's a think tank in Britain. We can euphemistically say it's a conservative think tank, not to say right wing. The current chair of the Board of Trustees of Policy Exchange is David Frum, who is a well-known neoconservative, co-author of a book with Richard Perl, and therefore very much in that circle of what we often call neocons. The think tank Policy Exchange has a special relationship with the Conservative Party in the UK, is considered important, is even sometimes thought of as a kind of breeding ground for young conservative intellectuals and politicians in the UK. So it's interesting that they would be the ones to carry out a big poll, and they didn't actually carry it out. They delegated that to ICM, which is a polling company, but they're the ones who presumably designed the original questions and who wanted to do this. And it's a large poll, seems to be decently done scientifically if you overlook the actual questions that they ask and their goals and their interpretation. About 3,000, roughly, Muslims in the UK surveyed, and they also surveyed a control group of a little over 2,000 people who were meant to represent the UK population as a whole, so they could then contrast the control group with British Muslims. So that's the gist.
Great. And David Frum, just so people know, wasn't he involved in the Bush administration in the build-up to the war and taking us to Iraq?
Yeah, Tim. I'm afraid to say he came from my country, Canada, one of our great contributions.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, his mother was a very famous, a very well-known journalist in Canada. And, of course, it's a little creepy when you think of a group that was actually described by a major Muslim organization in Britain, the Muslim Council of Britain, described Policy Exchange as, quote, an anti-Muslim organization. So think about it. You know, a party which represents the political right in the UK, which is thought of as antagonistic to Muslims by major organization of Muslims in the UK, decides to carry out this detailed survey, which, you know, breaks down Muslims into different groups according to where they're living in the country and asks very detailed questions about what they believe and think and their values and so on and so forth. I mean, this is a gift, really, to British police, British intelligence. You begin to see that there is a kind of a fuzzy line, actually, between a public opinion poll and an intelligence operation. And I'm not suggesting that British intelligence was directly involved in it. I have no reason to believe they were, but I'm just saying it'd be very useful to them, even though the results clearly show that British Muslims are not the slightest bit interested in carrying out acts of violence. Quite the contrary, they are less sympathetic to acts of political violence and terrorism than the control group. So in that sense, there's nothing very interesting here in terms of targeting Muslims. Yet, despite that, Policy Exchange manages to try and find a way to interpret this poll to make Muslims look kind of scary and dangerous. Yeah, it's clearly one of their aims.
Yeah, and we've done a good job of that here in this country, too, with our media. So that seems to be the goal. So tell us a bit about the poll. What were some of the questions and how did they respond?
Oh, well, there's all sorts of questions that ask them about, you know, how do they feel about police presence and general political views, questions that are meant to test their loyalty to the UK and their strong feelings about their religion. But the question that I focused on, actually more than one, but a few of them in the poll for my article had to do with the issue of 9/11. I thought it was interesting that a poll of British Muslims would even ask this, for one thing. But then, of course, I found the results interesting. So here was the question. Who do you think was responsible for 9/11? And the responses were, they were given five choices, by the way. First was Al-Qaeda / Muslim terrorists. Then it said Jews. Then it said the American government. Then other, and then don't know. Well, 52% said they didn't know, which is interesting. But even more interesting is the fact that 4% said Al-Qaeda or Muslim terrorists. In other words, an almost insignificant number of British Muslims believe the official narrative of 9/11, because however you want to express that official narrative, that official account of 9/11, the fact that it was supposedly carried out by Muslim terrorists is definitely an essential part of the narrative. So if you don't believe that, you really are not a believer in the official narrative. This means that here we have a population of people in the middle of the UK, in other words, in the middle of the country, which is really strongly trying to convince them, and by that I mean all major media, all parties in government, that, in fact, this was an act carried out by Muslim terrorists, and they almost all reject it. Now, that's a strong result. That's a very interesting result. I'm not surprised that our conservative interpreters were worried about that or wanted to make something out of it. Also, we find 31% said the American government was responsible for 9/11. Mm. So, okay, there's a bit of a contrast there. 4% Muslim terrorists, 31% American government. Now, I don't want to pretend this is hugely surprising. There have been lots of polls about 9/11 before, and we can talk about that if you want, what the findings are from it. Yeah, well, the first thing that's obvious is that Muslims in the world, speaking in general terms here, have never bought the official story of 9/11 the way, for example, we in North America, we meaning non-Muslim mainstream people of various faiths and non-faiths have bought it. I mean, they just haven't. So you can find many polls on this, and they go over many different countries. This is Muslims from, and not all Arabs. For example, Turks are great disbelievers in the official narrative. They're not Arabs. People from Pakistan, they're not Arabs. Pakistanis are probably the strongest group in the world in terms of rejecting the official story, but also the Arab world. So, for example, Egypt, they don't believe it. Probably the percentage of Muslims worldwide who accept the official narrative, based on the polls we have, is not more than 17%. That's the maximum.
In your article, I noticed you have two other polls in here, a 2008 and a 2011 poll, and it looks like as time goes on, less and less Muslims believe the official story because the numbers keep going down.
That's why I gave those two results. In the 2008 one, there were 21% roughly who assigned guilt to Al-Qaeda, and by 2011 it was 17%. And we find this result generally when we're lucky enough to have the same question asked in the same words in more than one poll. Generally speaking, skepticism, as far as I can tell, has been increasing. Skepticism toward the official narrative has been increasing over time, not only with Muslims, but with others as well. So that's why I say I think it's probably no more than 17% of Muslims worldwide accept the official narrative of 9/11. So in that sense, no surprise that Muslims are rejecting it. But still, 4% is lower as a percentage of people that believe the story. It's lower than usual. I could only find one result lower than that, actually. It was one poll done in Pakistan a couple of years ago, which had 3% of people. But basically, what I just find it fascinating that this population has managed to achieve its own worldview, or at least its own interpretation of this incident, and be resilient in maintaining that and even increasing that in the midst of all this propaganda that's going on around it. And, of course, as it happens, because of 10 years of research, I think British Muslims are right. I mean, if I thought they were wrong, I would have a different view of this, perhaps, but I think they're right.
Absolutely.
So kind of encouraging.
Yeah, it is encouraging. And I have a question around that. You know, I'm wondering why more Muslims don't speak out if they get this in great numbers. And I guess I understand partly why they don't, but I'd be curious to know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I think the very fact of how this poll was carried out gives us an idea of why they don't speak out. I mean, they're being intensely studied. They're being considered suspicious. Their loyalty is being questioned. There's a string of quote-unquote terrorist events that keeps happening in the West, which are immediately blamed on them. And that just goes to maintain the global war on terror and to maintain the fear and the suspicion and all that. Now, in my view, the majority of those terrorist incidents are frauds, just like 9/11. They
Yes.
have signs all over them that they are state operations meant to keep this absurd conflict, war on terror, going. And I don't say they're all frauds, but the ones I have actually begun looking into usually bear the same signs that we're familiar with, or having studied 9/11 and the anthrax attacks. And those two I've studied in great detail. And so when I see the same signs coming up, I go, oh, not this again. I think at this point in history, we have to assume that when one of these events happens, our initial assumption has to be that it's a false flag attack, it's a state operation, and that's the assumption. We could be wrong, but in that case, we'll need evidence to convince us we're wrong. In other words, my own perspective has changed from what it would have been maybe 12 years ago. 12 years ago, I might have said, well, I know there's lots of state deception. I've been studying war for a long time, but let's assume the official story of one of these things is correct, unless we see evidence to the contrary. I don't believe that anymore. There's so much fraud, I think we have to flip it and say, I'm going to assume it's a fake unless I see evidence.
Until proven otherwise, right.
Yeah.
And they all have some of the same characteristics. Maybe you could share with us what are some of the characteristics that you see that all of these have that lead us to believe they're false.
Well, one of the things is that they're usually able to identify the perpetrator very quickly. Another is that they often kill the perpetrator, so that there's no trial, there's no airing for the public of evidence. Police get to say what they'll show us and what they won't show us. And even what they do show us is often flimsy in the extreme. Their so-called perpetrators often make a point of leaving their identification at the scene. You know, they accidentally leave it in the taxi, as with the Charlie Hebdo attacks, or they have their passport on them when they're shot down, which is the case mm-hmm. with Michael Zihafibo in Ottawa, 2014. Again, a couple of recent incidents. Once again, we have identification found. I mean, come on, you know. And that obviously reminds us of the 9/11 case of, actually, there's a whole host of identification found at various sites. The most famous one is the passport found at the World Trade Center, which somehow escaped the conflagration, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Saddam al-Sukami. I think that's the passport that was found. But that was just an example that we had in Pennsylvania. We had all kinds of identification.
Their bandanas or something. Yeah.
even though there's no claim.
Right.
And they found all kinds of, you know, business cards and an ID and stuff supposedly at the Pentagon. I mean, that was so stupid. I can't see how anyone could believe it. So when we see this being replicated again, so really you can come up with a checklist, and there are such. Some people have come up with checklists.
Mm-hmm.
You can find them on the internet. You know, if you find the following 12 characteristics, it's probably a fraud.
I know one of them is that there's usually some kind of a drill that's gone on before or during the event, and also often the perpetrators are known by the FBI and have connections to these government and intelligence agencies.
Right. We had both of those, for example, in October 2014 in Canada, we had two so-called Muslim terrorist events that happened very quickly, that is very closely together. One was, I think, October 20th, one was 22nd. These are really rare in Canada. And they had everything that we're talking about here. They had drills. They had all kinds of foreknowledge. I think our federal police denied that there was any warning at all. And actually, there were at least six, some of them very specific. There was a huge training exercise that had been going on for some time, which was carried out to simulate an attack in Quebec followed by attack in another city. Well, guess what? October 20th, province of Quebec, attack. 2 days later, attack in another city, Ottawa, and so on. So that one was there. What was the other one you mentioned? Oh, the RCMP knew these people. Yeah, sure. Well, the Maldives had actually been having regular visits with one of these guys, and the other guy had a big criminal record, and, you know, and they knew all about him, and he was a homeless man who somehow suddenly managed to get hold of a car and a gun. And I wrote a whole report about that one. It was so silly. So those are two more characteristics. We find them all over the place. There they are, Boston Marathon, good training going on.
Oh, yes. So, and another example of the supposed perpetrators being connected to the FBI and had been watched by them, and they'd been to their home and all
right.
of that.
So your initial question was, why do Muslims not speak out? And I think we're answering it as we go along. I mean, they're under attack. It's not paranoia. Most of them are ordinary folks who want to live a normal life in the country that they're in. And if they're in the West, they want to a large extent, integrate. I don't mean give up their religion and all their beliefs and so on, but on the whole, they want to integrate. They want their kids to be able to go to school without being harassed. They don't want people looking at them like terrorists when they go to work in the day. And so it's been my experience, certainly within my own country, knowing the Muslim community in my own city and in neighboring cities, that generally on this issue, they keep their head down. And that doesn't mean that some of them aren't grateful when others of us are willing to speak out about it. It's safer for me to speak about it than it is for them.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Now, in this poll that was done that you were talking about here in Britain, how did they twist or spin the results? Then that's why you were motivated to write the article.
Well, one of the things, I mean, they couldn't do much about violence since, as I say, Muslims answered questions about political violence by being less sympathetic to it than the control group. So they latched on to a couple of other terms or other ideas. One was that somehow Muslims were racists and were blaming it on Jews. But the others were two different terms. One was conspiracy theory and one is extremism. So they asked this question about 9/11, I think, partly to entrap the population and to say, look at them, they're conspiracy theorists. And we'll now argue that conspiracy theory is very dangerous, that it feeds into what they call extremism and terrorism, and that therefore it's scary and we need to try and work on that. So the results that I gave you would show that Muslims in the UK don't believe the official story of 9/11. Somehow Policy Exchange wants to make that into a scary finding. Now they do it, first of all, they ask several questions in the poll in which they use the term conspiracy theory and in which they use the term extremism. They never define either term, okay? They never define. That's really, really important because these are two very important terms in the war on terror. Conspiracy theory has been just a goldmine for people who are trying to smear those of us who question the official story. It sounds so intellectually sophisticated. sophisticated. Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, ha, 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 whereas I am sophisticated. But, of course, you don't define it, because if you define it, it'll turn out that what you're saying makes no sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, conspiracy theory, the obvious meaning of that is a theory which asserts that a conspiracy took place. Right? I mean, that's the obvious meaning, and that's the way it was used, for example, after the John Kennedy's assassination. There were two choices. One was that there was a lone gunman, usually said to be Lee Harvey Oswald, and the other was that there was a conspiracy, meaning more than one person. And a conspiracy is where two or more people get together in secret to plan an immoral or illegal act, right? So what would that mean, to say that there's a conspiracy theory about 9/11? I mean, it's obvious there's no lone gunman option.
Right.
No way one person, no matter how evil they are, they didn't do the whole thing. They didn't hijack four planes simultaneously, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So it's obvious, in other words, that regardless of who you think did 9/11, it was two or more people. Well, it was more than two. It was multiple people. Obviously, it was a crime. And obviously, they didn't plan it in public, right? They mm-hmm. planned it in secret. Therefore, it was a conspiracy. And therefore, using the obvious meaning of the term conspiracy theory, there is no theory that can possibly account for 9/11 except a conspiracy theory. And therefore, the decision we have to make isn't between conspiracy theory and something else. It's between the government, the official conspiracy theory, in which Al-Qaeda are the conspirators, and one or the other conspiracy, right?
Right.
So, for example, of course I think people conspired. Of course. And a lot of them were people in the state, in the government of the U.S. Others were, may have been in foreign intelligence agencies, so on and so forth. So I'm going on at length about this just to say that, as you obviously already know this, but I'm saying this for people listening, you know, this conspiracy theory term is usually meant purely as a propaganda term. And the people who use it very seldom are willing to unpack it, because it just doesn't work when you begin looking at it. So here we have a survey in which people are asked about conspiracy theories without defining it, and they're asked about extremism, which is also a very important term, and there's no definition. So here's an example of a question asked on the poll in the UK. Quote, "From time to time, we all come across so-called conspiracy theories," and that's put in quotation marks, "which supposedly explain events in a different way to commonly held beliefs. You may have seen or heard about conspiracy theories about, for example, the attacks on the Twin Towers in New York on 9/11. To what extent do you agree or disagree with the following statements?" They then give a few, and here's one statement. "Conspiracy theories are started by extremists trying to dupe Muslims into support for their views." Okay? I mean, when I read that in the poll, I just started to laugh. I mean, that's obvious propaganda. First of all, this violates the basic principles of public polling. You never ask a question using a term that you don't define and that is seriously unclear. So that's the first sign that this isn't a sincere public poll. It's something else going on. And I think what's going on is a form of entrapment, actually, trying to get people to say certain things that can be used against them.
Right. And another word they used is duped. Like, if you believe in conspiracy theories, you've been duped by extremists. And who wants to be duped?
Well, who wants to be duped, indeed?
Yeah.
And who wants to be associated with extremism, which is the other term here? Because you have to remember that there's a whole thing, debate going on in the UK for some years now about this concept of extremism. Finally, I found it defined in a UK government document from around 2011, where extremism is defined as something, I'm sorry, I don't have the thing here, but it's something like public opposition to fundamental British values. Think about that for a minute. Well, they give examples of fundamental British values, and the examples are things you and I would, I'm sure, like democracy and tolerance of different faiths and so on. But there are several things going on here. First of all, those values are not distinctly British. There are people in all kinds of parts of the world who affirm those. But secondly, those are precisely the values that the war on terror is putting at risk. And I'm suspicious of anybody who defines a term like extremism in terms of national values. It reminds me of, you know, the house on un-American activities.
Yeah.
As soon as you're talking about somebody's in trouble if they're un-American or they're un-British or something, then you've got something really fishy going on here.
Yes.
So extremism is a term that's under debate in the UK for good reason. I think it should be rejected completely. But part of the reason it's being defined that way is because the people in government who are pushing this notion of extremism do not want it to be, how shall I put this? They do not want violence to be an essential part of the definition. I mean, if extremism were to mean what many people assume it means, that people are doing some kind of horrible, unjustified violence, then obviously Sherrold and Graham McQueen are extremists because we're not pushing violence. But they want us to be part of that circle, just like they want British Muslims as a whole to be in danger of this thing called extremism. So they are deliberately creating a category, and they say this, like when he was Prime Minister, Cameron publicly said that he was against all forms of extremism, including, folks, nonviolent extremism. That's his term. And what we see in this poll that I'm discussing here is that the current effort by the political right in the UK is to make so-called conspiracy theories, generally undefined, okay, to make that a part of this thing called nonviolent extremism.
Yes.
Where I'm going.
Yes, so it's an attack on anybody who challenges the official story.
Absolutely. An attack which has a very scary direction here, because what they're really heading for, and they've got legislation in the works in the UK, is to not only make so-called conspiracy theorists, you know, like us, to not only make us taboo and somehow polluted and ridiculous and all those things which they've been trying to do all along, but to actually make it illegal to hold such opinions. It's something we need to be aware of this.
I agree. And now with the attack on the, quote, fake news, they're trying to get at all the alternative outlets where we can share this information, and they're attacking us that way, too. And they're going to make that even illegal to do. Yeah, it is a major attack. I see that. I'm glad you're bringing that up.
Yeah, it's a dangerous assault which needs to be checked. And unfortunately, mainstream media, political parties have had a fair bit of success in the West in this employment of terms like conspiracy theory. And so it's possible that they'll get some fishy law through a parliament here or there that will make it much harder for us to have freedom of expression and freedom of research and to find out and communicate the truth about our times.
You've just been listening to the first part of an interview with Dr. Graham McQueen, Canadian professor and author. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of that interview. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Kenna, the stunning size and scope of women across the country who turned out to say, we won't go back, the historic Women's March in Washington. Now, welcome to our first day. We won't go away. Marches in Washington chanted. Oh, so many more than 500,000 strong. Women, many wearing pink caps shaped like pussy ears, lampooning Trump's misogynist assaults on women, came to what they proclaimed to be the epicenter, Washington, D.C., to express their repudiation of Trump, his administration, and the Republican Party's corrosive rhetoric and retrogressive policies.
The Washington rally was easily one of the biggest demonstrations in that city's history, and mirrored the outpouring of more than a million women. It was, I think, 3 million people who turned out everywhere from New York City, Philadelphia, Chicago, Los Angeles, to Mexico City, Paris, Berlin, London, Prague, and Sydney.
A historic day. We'll hear some outstanding interviews from who? We the sisters, we the peoples. Here we are with this incredible, chaotic, wonderful cacophony of voices and women, and I maintain that there certainly are easily a million people here. And what do you know? All of a sudden, I came across four people who have signs saying they are Montanan women. So I want to find out what brings people all the way to Washington, D.C. from Montana. So why don't you tell us who you are and what brings you here?
I'm Nancy Winslow. I came from Missoula, Montana. What brought me here is I'm really concerned we've got someone at the White House who's not stable and that might start nuclear war. We can live through the corruption, the different things that are happening with reproductive rights, which I think are all really big concern. But what really has me scared, that he's going to start a nuclear war, because he is so easily provoked. You can provoke him with a tweet. That's why I came from Montana, because I'm really scared.
Who are you, and how did she convince you to come down here also, or did you convince her?
I'm her niece. I'm Camille Winslow. I'm from Seattle originally, but my mom is from Montana. We all kind of decided to go together. We all wanted to go. We decided that we wanted to go big. We thought this was a big movement. This is really feels like the start of something, and we really wanted to be in the heart of it. There are marches in Seattle and in other cities around the world, but we really wanted to be where the action was happening in Washington, D.C.
Your friends, do they feel similar to you? You are the youngest looking one of this crew here. Your generation, do you think that they share your concerns?
I have a lot of friends who are marching in their own towns right now, in Seattle and also in the town where I go to school in Bellingham, Washington. Some of them just couldn't afford to come out here to Washington, D.C. and march, but they all feel the same way, and they all are protesting in their own way in their own cities.
Okay, so we also got, and I think you're actually her mom, and I see you have a sign that says Mothers and Daughters for Choice, My Body, My Choice. As you listen to your daughter speak, what are some of your thoughts? Is it a little bit of, oh my God, we have to do this again, or?
Yes, it is. It's, oh my God, we have to do this again. I campaigned very heavily for the pro-abortion, pro-choice campaign in Washington State before Roe v. Wade. Yeah, I've been around a few years. And so it does feel a little bit sad that we're doing the same things. What feels great is the turnout today. There are so many more women aware of it, more aware of their need to protect their reproductive rights, and I found that thrilling. And I was thrilled that my daughter designed these great signs. Well, we have some really artistic skill here. And we have a fourth member of the crew, another gorgeous sign, Equality Now, We Deserve Fundamental Rights. Your relationship to the other three sisters here?
Yes, I'm number three. We actually are a family of seven girls. So we were lucky three of us got to come here. All of us feel pretty much the same way about our president, as hard as that is to say, he is our president now. And I decided to come. Camille, my niece, really energized her mom and I to, it's like, yes, let's do this. We need to go. I just had a very positive reaction to that, because I was so depressed after the election to think that our voices, really the majority of the country, were not heard. Felt powerless until I heard about the march, and it gave me a new mission and a new way to for my voice to be heard.
So you're here in this incredible sea of pink, and for anybody who doesn't get it, there are pink pussy hats by the tens of thousands. Your thoughts about what's unfolding before us today, which, as I said, is absolutely chaotic and wonderful, because clearly there's so many people here, there can't even be some semblance of order.
As we predicted, that there would be a much bigger turnout than expected, but it even exceeded those expectations. There's such a great sense of solidarity among us. Yesterday I ran across some gals with the pink hats, and I'd just been through all these Trump supporters who are here for the inauguration feeling, and then the gals in the pink hats, I go, oh, sisters, and we all just gathered and hugged. We were from all parts of the country, but it just gave, it's such a great sense of solidarity with the men that are here, the women that are here, the young women, their women who brought their children, male children as well, to really get the sense of the power that can happen when we all gather together.
Well, thank you, and good luck with all of us. What happens when we go back home to Montana's, to Brooklyn, to our various areas, and power to the sisters. Thank you. What brought you all the way to Washington, D.C.?
Oh, protect Mother Earth.
Where'd you come from?
We come from the Iroquois Confederacy, the Haudenosaunee people.
Right. Mm-hmm. And how far did you travel today?
We traveled from upstate New York and into Canada.
So tell me a little bit more about the message that you would like to see here today.
We have time to help our planet, and we have the brightest, beautiful people in the world to do it. Let's shed a light on the science of climate change and take a look at what's real and what's not, and make our new leadership accountable for every action. And if they're illegal, they need to be penalized and made accountable for that, too.
And you are?
I'm Jill Claus.
Thank you for talking to us. Excuse me, do you mind if I ask what brought you here today?
My name is Victoria Humphreys. I'm from Gila River Indian Community in Sacaton, Arizona. I live in the district now, and we see everything unfolding firsthand. What's happening when our indigenous people come out here and they're working on trying to pass policy or try to get some law pushed through just so that we can be able to have clean drinking water, and we keep getting denied it? That's a problem. So that's why we're here today, for our people, for our land, for our women, to protect them, to protect Mother Earth.
And do you feel the kind of jubilation that most folks seem to feel?
Now that we're moving, absolutely.
In other words, a little too much speechifying and not enough marching. But thank
it.
You all for coming to Washington. Do you mind if I can grab the three of you for a moment? Your signs. We are all immigrants. Who are you? What brought you here? And your particular sentiment around the participation of immigrants in this march today.
I'm from Bethesda, from Maryland, right here. And I believe that everyone except the Native Americans have come here to make this country better. That's what makes our country great. We should not close the doors to anyone. We should all welcome them.
This is your home turf, in a manner of speaking. Is that sentiment general to the community that you're residing in?
We're very much for human rights in our area. We welcome immigrants. We have a very international community, and we're stronger for it.
And what is your general sentiment, any of you, actually, about what you're seeing unfolding today?
Hopefully day one of an uprising that may take 4 years.
And
one day is enough of the presidency.
What about the outpouring of people, which is quite extraordinary?
This is amazing. I've never seen anything like this, any inauguration, anything like this. This is really the majority of the people speaking today.
And who am I speaking with?
I'm Sonali Roy from Bethesda, Maryland.
Rahana Farrell from Princeton, New Jersey.
And you are?
I'm Ronan Roy from Maryland.
From Maryland. Okay, so it was a good day?
It was a good day.
Great. Good day. Thank you all. So I wonder if I can grab you two for 2 minutes to just tell me why you're here. I'm particularly keep building walls, we'll keep building bridges. And you have a sign that says Trump is the symptom, white supremacy is the sickness. Maybe you can just tell our radio station why you're here. And
I'm just here to protest Trump and to protest racism and sexism and all of the horrible things that are happening in the country. And it's not just Trump, but it's like a system that has been going on for so long that people are finally waking up to. And I'm just...
And where are you from?
From Plattsburgh, New York.
And what about yourself?
I'm from Albany, and I came with my sister for the same reasons. And we're taking a stand, and we're showing the new administration that we're going to fight back.
I think it's really amazing, and all the speakers were great, and it was just really special to be here.
And you are?
Johanna Katora.
Welcome to Washington. Now, wait a minute. There's a whole group of folks from Canada, and you came here for...
The march?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,
seven.
And how would I know the beautiful red and white scarves? Tell me why there are hundreds. Tell me why you're here.
Sure. Because we're neighbors. We've always been good neighbors. And this election has as much potential for hardship to you as it does for us in Canada, given free trade and the amount of our economy. Plus, we think that he's just a horrible man. Plus. Yes.
What about yourself?
I agree with that and what he said about women, and it's important to be here and show our support.
And it's a global problem. So globally, everyone has to stand up, take a stand.
What do you think about this outpouring of...
Phenomenal.
Have you ever seen anything like this?
We have to make sure that doesn't creep up into our country. Really.
Not the outpouring.
Not the outpouring, but that... So that we, so for us, it was come here to feel it surround us. We want to take that energy back into our country and make sure it doesn't happen.
How do people really continue the momentum that is expressed?
We have to keep talking about this, and we have to challenge people. We shouldn't be afraid to stand up. I want to try and get people to make sure that they vote in Canada.
That's the big thing.
To vote. What happened here is a lot of people didn't vote. So we're going to vote.
So look at it. You're getting all kinds of great enthusiasm.
Yeah.
So you are?
My name is Joanne, and I come from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. We all work for the city of Hamilton.
Fantastic. And you are?
Judy.
Grace.
Marge. Helen. Lynn.
Delighted to meet up with you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks. Enjoy.
Thanks. So since you're chanting, this is what democracy looks like, what does it mean?
So it means that it's open for everybody. Everybody has a voice and is represented by their government, not just the rich and powerful.
And what do you think the march today of all these incredible sisters, and not a small number of brothers either, what do you think that means towards the contribution to a democratic state?
I think that it is empowering people when they see this many different voices come forward. It makes them realize they too can have a voice. And so hopefully we'll all rise up and react and get involved.
Where did you come from?
I came from Wellington, Colorado, just about an hour north of Denver.
And you are?
My name is Sarah Ahola.
Are you heartened by what you see here today?
I am, very much so.
Good, thank you. Grab you for a couple of minutes for our radio station. Where are you all from?
New York.
New York, go figure. So what do you think about what happened here today?
I thought it was so exciting to be here. Yeah.
Why?
Why? Because we're fighting for people's rights. We want to be a part of a movement.
Is this your first large demonstration?
Yes.
What made it imperative for you to come to Washington?
The election and an inauguration of Donald Trump as the president of the United
States. So what happens when you go back to New York?
Keep fighting.
Keep going, yeah.
You got to call your local elected officials. You got to vote during midterm elections. You got to get involved in city and state politics.
Do your friends back in New York feel the same way?
Well, I try to make them feel the same way.
I'll bet you do.
I'm from Staten Island, so it's majority Trumpers.
You got a lot of work to do. And you are?
My name's Nicole.
And who are you?
Mari.
Julia.
All right. So where are you all from?
We're from this area.
Now I will tell you, many, many times I've gone to marches in D.C. and I haven't seen that many Washingtonians come on out. So what drove you out today? Why don't we start with you?
Just equal rights for all. That's what drove me out here. Medicare, immigrants, education, especially education. That's what brought me out here.
What about? You mean Betsy DeVos isn't exactly what you're after?
No, not at all. She has no educational experience. She doesn't know anything about public schools. I'm in the public schools. She knows nothing.
Are you a teacher?
Yes.
What grade level?
9 through 12.
What is it that Betsy DeVos really doesn't know about what you know about what is necessary to educate our youth?
I think that people need to know that we don't have as much money to work with as they think they do, that education is being nickel and dimed to death, and I really don't think it's being evenly distributed through all neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. What about yourself?
Yeah, I'm a retired teacher, retired this past year. I'm here for a number of reasons. This presidency has just brought out so much stuff that has been there, I guess, just come to the front. And I'm glad to see people are starting to address the needs of all the people, women, people from the LGBT community, the workers, everybody. And this is awesome.
So what do you think we do tomorrow? Is there, in your neighborhoods, specific organizations that you relate to that are going to continue to do the organizing to what? Unseat Trump? Make sure he's impeached in the next 6 months? Or
I think we start writing. We start writing our congressmen. We start writing our senators. And we keep writing. And we keep letting them know we're out here and that they work for us.
And people need to remember Congress works for us.
What about your students? What do they feel about these things?
Well, I retired, so
they're scared. I mean, a lot of the children who are immigrants are scared that their families are going to be broken up and sent away. And you try to abate their fears so that they're not so scared. But I don't even know what to say to them because I don't know what he's going to do.
Are you excited by what's unfolding in front of you, this endless array of women passing by?
Extremely impressed with this peaceful, enthusiastic, and ever-flowing demonstration.
Ever-flowing.
Yes, indeed. Because you look down there, you can still see the people walking. I mean, we came that way. The whole street is covered with people. It's amazing.
This is what democracy looks like.
That's right.
And you are?
My name is Britton.
And you're a Washingtonian?
Maryland.
Maryland. And yourself?
My name is Kathleen Mann.
And also from D.C. Hey, what about the issue of no representation, but plenty of taxation?
That's an ongoing thing. I tell people to write to anybody else, a senator, that you can write to, because it's kind of unfair that Congress uses this D.C. as its backyard. That's what I call it.
Without the right to? Because a lot of people don't even know that.
Yeah, we have to pay taxes. But we do not have representation in Congress at all.
Shocking, isn't it?
It is. And you're right. A lot of people don't know that.
Well, thank you.
Nice talking to you.
Great talking to you. Well, somebody just walked by and announced that there are 1.3 million people that are projected to have been marching today. And as somebody who's in the midst of this, I can testify to that as well. you have one of the more impactful signs here, Truth Matters, the World. Tell us about your sign and your message today.
Well, I was trying to make it succinct, and it does feel to me like we only have one planet, and the policies that Donald Trump wants to put in place are going backward on so many incredibly important issues. We don't have the time. I take the long view generally, but we don't have the time for bad policies on the environment right now.
And where did you come from to join this march?
I came from California.
Wait a minute. You got all kinds of marches going on in California. What drove you to Washington?
This is the epicenter of the resistance right now, and we wanted to be here, and I brought my daughter, and a bunch of us came from California.
That's fantastic. So is this your first mass demonstration?
Kind of.
She was a toddler, less than two, when we marched against the war in Iraq.
Yes, she lifted her eyebrows and said, and I vaguely remember that.
She had a sign around her neck that said, no kicking, no biting, no war, no fighting.
What do you think about this incredible display of unity, of passion, of righteousness that's parading before us today?
I think it's really important for people to see that they're not alone in the fight against the hatred that is caused by Donald Trump's messages. It's really important for people to be able to visualize that and to be able to see that people are united against the hatred that is put out from so many people against things that are uncontrollable for them, like their gender or their race or their sexuality.
Do your friends carry the same kind of sentiment that you're expressing here today?
Yeah, I have a lot of friends who are here from California.
As somebody who is in the younger generation here, I mean, what do you think this presidency might portend for this country that concerns you?
I'm just worried that there's going to be a lot of things that Donald Trump does in his presidency that are going to be really hard to turn around when it gets passed on to the next president, and hopefully things will be able to get better. But right now, there's just a lot of darkness and bad things that are just generally being put over everyone.
And what about when you folks go back to California? How to keep this momentum alive? How do we continue to do organizing?
That's a really good question. And I think for us, what we're doing and what we did, like for Christmas, we were said, okay, we're not doing gifts this year. We're donating to important causes so that there's more money in the coffers of people like the NRDC or Planned Parenthood or the ACLU or places where they're trying to fight the good fight. And it's going to take a lot of, I think, legal counsel to slow some of the worst changes, at least slow it down in the courts.
So it's an appropriate sign. Truth matters, and there's the whole world depicted on this beautiful sign. And whom have I been speaking to?
I'm Ava Boas.
Claire Ferrari.
All the way from California. Thanks for coming to Washington. Excuse me, I couldn't help but respond to both of your signs, actually. Well, you button Black Lives Matter, and then I will not go quietly back to the 1950s. So tell us what you mean by that. What did the 1950s represent that you think Trump holds as a kind of sword of Damocles over the participants of this march and all women?
I was born in the 40s, so for me the 50s were a period when I grew up, and my mother was a housewife, and women were, you know, the family unit was just in a different place. We did not have a lot of rights that have been afforded to us since then. And then I lived through the era of, you know, going to college in the early 60s and going back to work during the time of the big women's liberation movement, and forming my own career and still maintaining a family and a happy marriage. And I think the strength that women have had to demonstrate since the 40s in particular to get to the point that we are able to live our lives today and tell our young daughters and granddaughters what's available for them. Mm-hmm. I think all of that's threatened because Trump sees women, I don't care how much he says he loves women, he sees women strictly from a misogynistic perspective. I don't believe he understands a family unit that is a typical American family unit. And I think that he is someone who wouldn't hesitate to roll back all of the things that are important to me, certainly, and to my daughters and to my grandson, who has grown up in a world where he's seen strong women.
I am here with four sisters who are dressed as suffragettes. And I kind of heard you saying a moment ago you planned this for how long, and with who are these other women with you?
I'm here with my mother and my two aunts. And my aunts have been planning this for months. As soon as we heard the election results, we decided to come march. We met in the city a few days ago, and they told us about their costumes, and they had extras. So we decided to join in.
And what's the message of suffragettes?
Equality, trying to get votes, equal rights for women, equal rights for not just women, but men, trans, LGBTQ community, trying to show our new president that he does not speak for us, and we the people, we have the power, and we're not going to stand for everything he's been spewing out into the world.
So you must be enormously proud to hear your daughter say these things.
I am enormously proud of my daughter. I am enormously proud of both my kids. They're both kind, and they respect all kinds of people, everybody. And that is something that was sorely lacking from the president-elect and now the presidency.
And there's a historic context. I mean, yes. It's suffragettes. So what is the history of suffragettes, and you're choosing this outfit, say, really as a critique of president inaugurated now, Donald Trump?
During not just the election, but for his adult life, he's been recorded saying such terrible things that were disrespectful to women. And that's unbearable and intolerable. I mean, women are half the population of this country. Women's rights are human rights. But the suffragettes, they did so much to help not only women, but all Americans to have better lives. That's something we enjoy the privileges and the rights that we have because of them. And they bled and they died and they suffered and they had a very, very hard time. And people need to remember the sacrifices of people who come before, of all kinds of people who come before and put their lives on the line and made a difference. That now more than ever is important, because the ultimate lesson is that you have to be involved, and that it's not somebody else's job to make this work. It's each of our jobs to get up and get involved and become part of the movement if needed, but also part of government if needed, and to be citizens. Citizenship is not a spectator sport.
What area are you from? Chicago. Would you say that there are a number of other young people like yourself who feel similar to the sentiment you're expressing here today in your area?
Everyone I know, all of my friends, we came here to Washington, but I have friends who march in Chicago today. I have friends who are marching all around the country, and I have friends in China who are marching. And
China?
I studied Chinese and East Asian studies in college. Everyone I know, we're all outraged, and we're not going to stand for this, and we're not going to let them take our country in dark ages.
Was this a good day?
It was a good day.
For you too?
It was a great day.
It was a great day. And you are?
I'm Katie Erham.
And I'm Andrea Beatty.
It's good to have seen you here, and it's good to listen to and hear the sentiments. It's both a learning experience and helps build solidarity. Thank you both.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
in light of all the circumstances, commuting her sentence was entirely appropriate.
It is absolutely preposterous to hear people saying that there are no consequences for her actions. She has been tortured and imprisoned, denied basic medical care, and it is time for her to be free.
I'm proud that we maybe provided a good block downfield to help the movement advance. I don't think it is something that will be reversible.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Sri Lanka keeps its laws against same-gender sex. Ireland lifts ban on blood from currently inactive gay men. And trans whistleblower Chelsea Manning's shameful sentence commuted by Obama. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending January 21st, 2017. The government of Sri Lanka has rejected proposals to repeal criminal penalties for private consensual adult same-gender sex. The South Asian island nation's laws, remnants of British colonial rule since 1883, punish same-gender lovemaking with up to 12 years in prison. Sections 365 and 365A of the Penal Code outlaw carnal intercourse against the order of nature with any man, woman, or animal, and gross indecency with another person. An insider claimed that some cabinet ministers objected to repeal because it was yet another surreptitious attempt to recognize homosexuality. Health Minister Dr. Rajitha Senaratne told reporters that even in Europe, there are strong Catholic countries that do not support homosexuality. We are a Buddhist country, and we too are against it. She also claimed that the laws are inconsequential because they're rarely enforced. Equality activists charge that the very existence of the laws tacitly permit anti-LGBT harassment, extortion, and police abuse, all confirmed as commonplace in Sri Lanka, according to a report by Human Rights Watch last year. Cabinet ministers did, however, agree to include a ban on discrimination based on sexual orientation in a new National Human Rights Action Plan. Many activists remain cynical, however. Some note that denying human rights of any kind to LGBT people is clearly discrimination in itself. Others say that people are unlikely to respect sexual and gender minorities when the law doesn't.
U.S. President Barack Obama this week commuted the 35-year prison sentence of transgender whistleblower Army Private Chelsea Manning. She's scheduled to be released on May 17th after serving 7 years of her sentence in the men's military brig at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. That included long stretches of solitary confinement, rejection of her wish to present as female, denial of medical care related to her gender identity, hunger strikes, and 2 suicide attempts. Before her transition, then-military intelligence analyst Army Private Bradley Manning was convicted in 2010 of providing WikiLeaks with hundreds of thousands of secret government documents, including incident logs, diplomatic cables, and video of U.S. war atrocities in the largest leak of classified military documents in U.S. history. Manning has been damned as a traitor by her detractors, but hailed as a courageous whistleblower by her supporters. Evan Greer is the campaign director for Fight for the Future, an online First Amendment advocacy group. She celebrated Manning's pending release on the January 17th edition of the Pacifica Evening News.
Their action on Chelsea Manning was the only moral thing to do, and they were under an incredible amount of pressure to do it. The severity of Chelsea Manning's sentence was always unreasonable. Even for people who believe that what she did was wrong, she served more time than any other whistleblower in U.S. history. And I think this year, this ceased to be a debate about whether what Chelsea did was right or wrong and became highly focused on the U.S. government's deplorable treatment of her as a human being.
Greer said the presidential commutation demonstrates the power of grassroots organizing and of personal perseverance.
I think all credit goes to Chelsea herself and to all of the organizers that worked to get her free. It also sets a precedent for transgender prisoners and for transgender people in general. I think the treatment of her and the denial of her access to gender-related health care while in prison is something that became daily or monthly headlines and had an impact on the public's perception. And I think that will send a message to authorities in the future that that type of abuse won't be tolerated.
First Amendment activist Evan Greer. Manning tweeted her gratitude to the president on January 19th with, "Thank you, Barack Obama, for giving me a chance."
The good news is that the Republic of Ireland has lifted its lifetime ban on men who have sex with men donating blood. It's a remnant from the height of the AIDS panic of the 1980s. The not-so-good news is that gay and bisexual men still must have been celibate for 12 months before they'll be allowed to help save lives. Similar 12-month restrictions limit blood donations by men who have sex with men in the UK, Australia, Canada, the US, New Zealand, the Netherlands, and several other countries. Italy, Spain, Argentina, South Africa, Russia, and a few others screen blood donors based on their individual risk, rather than an across-the-board ban on a specific subgroup of the population. Germany, China, Austria, Thailand, and Turkey are among the countries that continue their blanket ban on blood donations by men who have sex with men.
Gambia's president, Yahya Jammeh, one of the world's most anti-queer leaders, refused to relinquish power after he was defeated in his re-election bid on December 1st. LGBT rights activists have joined others around the world to monitor the unfolding crisis. Jammeh refused to step down after initially conceding the election to his opponent, Adama Barrow. After Jammeh fired the Electoral Commission and demanded new elections, Barrow fled to nearby Senegal, where he was officially sworn into office as Gambia's new president on January 19th. After mounting global pressure, including a unanimous resolution from the UN Security Council calling on Jammeh to leave, troops from an alliance of neighboring West African countries entered the country on January 20th, intending to remove him by force if necessary. After his military leaders finally abandoned him, Jammeh has agreed to step down without bloodshed. The new president's thoughts on LGBT rights are not known, but local human rights activists say Adama Barrow couldn't be much worse than Jammeh, who had threatened to execute all LGBT people and claimed to be able to cure AIDS with a homemade concoction of herbs and bananas.
U.S. President Barack Obama's administration maintained a robust section on the official White House website devoted to LGBT rights, including a regularly updated blog detailing policy commitments and details about the White House's work to advance LGBT equality. "The president and his administration are dedicated to eliminating barriers to equality," the site declared, "fighting discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity, and engaging LGBT communities across the country." Immediately upon the inauguration of Donald Trump as the 45th U.S. president on January 20th, the Obama administration's comprehensive declaration of support for LGBT equality on the WhiteHouse.gov site was replaced with nothing. The LGBT rights section has been entirely deleted, along with other sections, including those addressing climate change and women's rights.
Trump seemingly called for blind allegiance in his inaugural address.
"From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. At the bedrock of our politics will be a total allegiance to the United States of America. And through our loyalty to our country, we will rediscover our loyalty to each other."
MSNBC commentator Chris Matthews called the tone of the speech
Hitlerian.
The new president's only announced LGBT-related policy position is a pledge to sign the Republican-backed First Amendment Defense Act, which would establish a federal law allowing overt discrimination against LGBT people by businesses and individuals based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction. A few hours after the inauguration, reports surfaced that John M. Gore, the private lawyer who's been defending HB 2 in federal court, that's North Carolina's so-called bathroom bill, has recused himself from that case to accept Trump's nomination to head the Civil Rights Division of what will presumably be Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions' Department of Justice.
And finally, everyone's favorite foursome, the titular Will and Grace with best buds Jack and Karen, along with Karen's delightfully insolent maid Rosario and closeted arch nemesis Beverly Leslie, are coming back to network television. The groundbreaking show racked up a total of 16 Emmy Awards from 1998 to 2006. Rumors of the reunion have swirled for months, especially after the four leads, played by Eric McCormick, Deborah Messing, Megan Mullally, and openly gay Sean Hayes, appeared in a brief Get Out the Vote pro-Hillary episode during the presidential election campaign. The video attracted close to 7 million views. The official announcement came during this week's annual Television Critics Association press tour in Southern California, when NBC confirmed that it had ordered a 10-episode run. Co-creators David Cohan and Max Muchnick will also be returning, along with the multi-award-winning James Burrows, who directed all the episodes during the show's original 8-year run.
Jennifer Salke, president of NBC Entertainment, told reporters that, "When we looked at that Get Out the Vote video, it was so clear that the magic of all those relationships was still there. Yes, it's later and time's passed, but it made me more interested to fill in what happened along the way. The fact that all four of the original stars were excited about getting back into production," she added, "is a testament to the joyful experience they had doing nearly 200 episodes. Openly gay co-creator Muchnick said in a statement that, "Dave and I are absolutely thrilled about the opportunity to write what Will, Grace, Jack, and Karen are thinking about in 2017.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 21st, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Commuting the sentence of U.S. Army whistleblower Private Chelsea Manning was one of the final official actions taken by President Barack Obama. Manning was convicted in 2013 for leaking the largest cache of classified documents in U.S. history, including the infamous video of an Apache helicopter killing two journalists and 10 other civilians in Baghdad in 2007. Although Manning's identity as a trans woman was publicly revealed shortly after her conviction, she was sentenced to serve 35 years in the men's military prison in Fort Leavenworth. Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Has more.
Whistleblower Chelsea Manning is now set to be free May 17th after Obama shortened her sentence from 35 years to 7. According to her attorney, she's already the longest-held whistleblower in U.S. history. She's been in military custody since May 2010. Manning leaked more than 700,000 classified files and videos to WikiLeaks about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and U.S. foreign policy. She's been subjected to long stretches of solitary confinement and denied medical treatment related to her gender identity. Chelsea Manning attempted to commit suicide twice last year. Joining us now are two of her attorneys. Nancy Hollander is Manning's appellate attorney. Chase Strangio of the ACLU represents Manning in a lawsuit against the Pentagon for denial of medical care related to her gender dysphoria. Chase Strangio, your response to what President Obama did yesterday.
Well, I first want to thank you and everyone who supported Chelsea over the years. The reality is that this was a mass mobilization effort, keeping her story alive, led by Chelsea herself and all of the people who made sure that nobody forgot the justice that she fought for and the incredible symbol of democratic principles and advocacy that she really embodies. Yesterday was an incredible day for us who care about her. As I've said time and time again, President Obama really had her life in his hands, and it's such a relief that he acted on the side of mercy and justice here.
Have you spoken to Chelsea?
Unfortunately, we haven't spoken to Chelsea, which is a bit concerning, but we're remaining hopeful that we will be able to speak with her today and actually be able to share this news. It's quite unusual for the individual to not be informed of their commutation with their attorneys, but we know that she was on standby waiting for this. I spoke with her yesterday around 2 p.m., and she was just her sort of hopeful, pragmatic self waiting for news, and we were all hoping and praying with her. So hopefully today we'll connect with her and get to share in this incredible moment that really did save her
life.
You
believe she was the longest-held whistleblower?
Absolutely. She has served 7 years already. The 35-year sentence was egregious at the time. It's particularly egregious in retrospect.
Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan released a statement protesting the commutation, saying, quote, "This is just outrageous. Chelsea Manning's treachery put American lives at risk and exposed some of our nation's most sensitive secrets. President Obama now leaves in place a dangerous precedent that those who compromise our national security won't be held accountable for their crimes." Meanwhile, Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona called the commutation a grave mistake, quote, "Thousands of Americans have given their lives in Afghanistan and Iraq, upholding their oaths and defending this nation. Chelsea Manning broke her oath and made it more likely that others would join the ranks of her fallen comrades. Her prison sentence may end in a few months, but her dishonor will last forever." Nancy Hollander.
It's just false. The Secretary of Defense at the time, Gates, said that the worst that happened was some embarrassment for the United States. There was not a single individual ever identified who was harmed by what Chelsea did. What Chelsea did actually helped the United States. It helped Americans. It helped people around the world understand about human rights violations, understand, bring war home to people. She wanted people to see what happens to somebody who gets killed, what happens to people in Iraq and Afghanistan. She wanted to make this real so that we would stop doing these kinds of things to people. And so what they're saying is exactly the opposite of what Chelsea did. There's never been a single bit of evidence that anybody was harmed or that national security was harmed.
Chase Strangio.
She has served 7 years. It is absolutely preposterous to hear people saying that there are no consequences for her actions. She has been tortured and imprisoned, denied basic medical care. She has suffered so much, and it is time for her to be free.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Congressional Republicans' loud and bitter responses made Chelsea Manning the number one question at the very last press conference President Obama would ever hold.
First of all, let's be clear. Chelsea Manning has served a tough prison sentence. So the notion that the average person who was thinking about disclosing vital classified information would think that it goes unpunished, I don't think would get that impression from the sentence that Chelsea Manning has served. It has been my view that given she went to trial, that due process was carried out, that she took responsibility for her crime, that the sentence that she received was very disproportionate relative to what other leakers had received, and that she had served a significant amount of time, that it made sense to commute and not pardon her sentence. I looked at the particulars of this case the same way I have the other commutations and pardons that I've done, and I felt that in light of all the circumstances, that commuting her sentence was entirely appropriate.
Still to come, Barack Obama's vision of LGBTQ rights during and after his presidency.
Hey. I'm Ellen DeGeneres, and you're listening to This Way Out. That was without cue cards, people.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Extra.
At his final press conference, President Obama called on the Washington Blade's Chris Johnson, who asked whether he thought the gains realized by the LGBTQ movement under his administration would be secure in the coming years.
I could not be prouder of the transformation that's taken place in our society just in the last decade. And I've said before, I think we made some useful contributions to it, but the primary heroes in this stage of our growth as a democracy and a society are all the individual activists and couples who courageously said, this is who I am, and I'm proud of it. And that opened people's minds and opened their hearts. And eventually, laws caught up. And I think that what we did as an administration was to help the society to move in a better direction, but to do so in a way that didn't create an enormous backlash and was systematic and respectful of the fact that, you know, in some cases these issues were controversial. I think that the way we handled, for example, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, being methodical about it, working with the Joint Chiefs, making sure that we showed this would not have an impact on the effectiveness of the greatest military on earth, and then to have Defense Secretary and Bob Gates and a chairman and Mike Mullen and the Joint Chiefs who were open to evidence and ultimately worked with me to do the right thing. I am proud of that. But again, none of that would have happened without this incredible transformation that was happening in society out there. You know, when I gave Ellen the Presidential Medal of Freedom, I meant what I said. I think somebody that kind and likable projecting into living rooms around the country, that changed attitudes. And that wasn't easy to do for her. And that's just one small example of what was happening in countless communities all across the country. So I'm proud that in certain places we maybe provided a good, block downfield to help the movement advance. I don't think it is something that will be reversible because American society has changed. The attitudes of young people in particular have changed. That doesn't mean there aren't going to be some fights that are important, legal issues, issues surrounding transgender persons. There's still going to be some battles that need to take place. But if you talk to young people, Malia, Sasha's generation, even if they're Republicans, even if they're conservative, many of them would tell you, I don't understand how you would discriminate against somebody because of sexual orientation. That's just sort of burned into them in pretty powerful ways.
From the lips of outgoing President Barack Obama to the ears of newly inaugurated President Donald Trump.
This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and leisure for This Way Out. My partner, who ordinarily is allergic to the news, and I sat rapt in front of the television the first time when President Obama said LGBT and then the words lesbian and transgender. Of course, by then we knew this president was on our side. We were on his side, too. We stayed home from work to watch his first inauguration. I still remember watching President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. We both held our breath because we knew that not everybody would be happy to see the first African-American president. Between our moments of awe, my partner tended to me nonchalant. It's about time, she remarked dryly when I told her that because of the Obama administration, hospitals that took money from the federal government had to honor the medical power of attorney papers of same-sex couples. She was right, of course. It was about time that we had some protections under the law. We are of that generation of lesbians who are used to not having any rights. My partner is a drummer, and to be honest, we came to enjoy marching in the streets. There always seemed to be a drum contingent to hook up with. At the time, I was a performance poet, and I could count on offending people at my readings at the more conventional venues. It was no secret that I rather enjoyed it when people walked out. My partner and I never imagined we'd be legally married someday. At the second inauguration for President Obama, we learned about a poet named Richard Blanco. He was the first Hispanic person and the first openly gay poet to recite a poem at a presidential inauguration. I reviewed several of his books for This Way Out. President Obama made history again at one of his State of the Union addresses.
As Americans, we respect human dignity even when we're threatened. That's why we defend free speech and advocate for political prisoners and condemn the persecution of women or religious minorities or people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. We do these things not only because they are the right thing to do, but because ultimately they will make us safer. I want future generations to know that we are a people who see our differences as a great gift. That we're people who value the dignity and worth of every citizen. Man and woman, young and old, black and white, Latino, Asian, immigrant, Native American, gay, straight. I have no more campaigns to run. I know because I won both of them.
Thank you, President Obama, for 8 years of your service, for your personal sacrifices, for the wonderful example you set with your beautiful family, and for being a secure man. Thank you also for your commitment to the LGBTQ community. Because of you, we are stronger and ready to take on whatever comes next. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Can it keep on moving forward? Keep on moving forward. Keep on moving forward. Never turning back. Never turning back. Never turning back. Never turning back.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, John Dyer V and Jessica Andrea contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Thanks also this week to the Pacifica Evening News and to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Nina Simone and Emma's Revolution performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who have made this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 2NUR Newcastle, New South Wales, WSMU North Dartmouth, Massachusetts, KRUX Las Cruces, New Mexico, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The United States used to be the site of some of the most militant class struggle in the Western world, but today the working class is frequently seen as a conservative force. Is there any truth to that characterization, which dates back to the 1950s and 60s? How should we understand the general absence of mass, class-based, collective resistance during the last 40 years of neoliberalism? Why has the left been able to mobilize people in large numbers on occasion, but not been able to translate those successes into sustained mass movements? And might that change under Donald Trump? To pick apart these huge questions, I'm joined by David McNally. He's an activist and professor of political science at York University in Toronto. He's the author of many books, including most recently Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism. In the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I have been his editor. David, one of the pillars of Marxism is that the working class is a potentially revolutionary class who can bring down capitalism. But since at least the 1960s, many on the left have given up on the working class as a revolutionary subject. Why is that?
Well, I think what's interesting is that the reasons for this in the 1960s and the reasons today are quite distinct. And what I mean by that is that in the 1960s, we had come through a period beginning right after the Second World War, pretty much as soon as the war ended in 1945, where working class living standards in the industrial core heartlands of Western capitalism rose persistently year after year after year, so that by the time we got to the late 1960s, heading into the era of the new left that really blossoms in the late 60s, early 70s, the working class in the global north seem to be directly benefiting from capitalist growth and development. Life seemed to be getting better, at least in material terms, in terms of their capacity to afford food and housing and creature comforts of life, automobiles, appliances, and so on. And so the idea became pretty widespread that in the global north, the working class had a material interest in the preservation and expansion of capitalism. And that raised big questions around the famous Marxian slogan that the workers have nothing to lose but their chains. Interestingly, as virtually everyone, even in the mainstream, will admit, working class living standards have not been rising over the last quarter century or more in the United States, Canada, etc. In fact, for the majority of working class households, there has been a declining quality of life in terms of the growing precarity of employment, the downward movement of wages and benefits, the erosion of union protections as more and more work is non-labor, non-union, not protected by collective agreements, and so on. And of course, this has led to all of the discussions as to what happens to the working class anger under conditions of economic and social decline. So it's not that people are today arguing, I think, about a broad-based material interest in the system. What people are rightly registering is that there has been a decline in organized working-class opposition, that the retreat of unions, their massive social decline, and alongside that, the political retreat of some of the historic parties associated with labor movements, whether it's the Labor Party in Britain or the socialists and communists in France or our own New Democratic Party in Canada, where I live. These parties have all shifted dramatically to the right. It becomes at least a fair debate in what sense they even remain working class parties. And so it is the political presence of a kind of working class opposition, which is, I think, now what the debate is really about or ought to be about. I think those who argue that working class people in the global north are clearly materially benefiting when their lives are more stressed out and more precarious, when there's greater hardship, I think that argument is very weak. But I think where the left must face up to a serious challenge is on this other side. That is to say, the decline of an organized political presence, be it through unions or political parties, of a kind of working class oppositional politics. Now, the one other point I would make in this regard is that we confront, I think, today a really challenging paradox, which is that although organized expressions of working class politics are in decline, they episodically flare up and manifest themselves. And of course, they do so with all kinds of contradictions. But I don't think that there's any doubt but that we ought to read the Bernie Sanders campaign phenomenon in the U.S. as an expression of a kind of searching for a left, class-based oppositional politics. And I say that fully aware of all the contradictions of that campaign having been associated with the Democratic Party and the like. Nevertheless, I think as a broad political phenomenon, we can see there that there is, if I can put it in these terms, an aspiration without an outlet. There's a political aspiration which simply has no sustained organizational expression. And so for me, that's the real challenge at this point. Not that workers have no interest in fundamental social transformation, because I think we can make a very powerful case that they do. I think the real challenge is to show that they have the capacity to do so.
Well, we'll talk a lot more about the present and many of the issues that you're flagging as we go on. But I just want to stay for a moment with the history. You said a few minutes ago that we really need to think differently about how the working class was seen in the 1960s and how they're seen today under neoliberalism. So just staying for a bit more with that earlier period before there was this really significant change in the way that capitalism organized itself. One of the things that seems interesting, striking about how the working class was seen in the 1960s is that with the exception of some radical Marxist groups, in the main, there was an assumption that the working class in a country like the United States, as you say, was invested in capitalism, in fact, bought off, and that the revolutionary subject had to be found elsewhere. And for some people, it was third world revolutionaries, movements in the third world. For other people, it was people of color in the ghettos of the United States, one particular slice of the population. And yet what seems interesting is that, looking back, is that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, there was actually an explosion of working class militancy, although a lot of it was really rank and file, and interestingly involved women and people of color and people in the service sector, teachers, who are often not the poster children for manufacturers working in organized labor. Do you think that's a contradiction, that that kind of labor militancy took place at a time when so much of the left was not looking to the working class?
Yes, I do think that's right. And I think part of what you're describing is a very long-standing problem that a left which is not rooted in workplaces and trade unions often encounters, and that is the confusion of the often highly bureaucratic leaderships of the labor movement with the rank-and-file membership. There's no doubt that many of the labor leaders of the 1960s and early 1970s expressed very limited and sometimes even conservative politics on some of the burning questions of the era. Now, we need to be careful there. One of the things which really stands out, for instance, when you look at Martin Luther King's last couple of years, is the number of trade unions he spoke to, the number of trade union conferences that he was invited to come and speak both about the civil rights movement, but also about his new call for a poor people's campaign. So at the level of official leaderships, there were some meaningfully progressive unions because of their historic traditions, often going back to the 1930s and 40s. But nevertheless, I think that it's fair to say that on civil rights, on the war in Vietnam, and on the issues that were affecting rank-and-file members in the workplaces, on the shop floor of auto factories and so on, that this leadership was often fairly conservative and out of touch with its members. So if you didn't have direct contact with working class people or their organizations, it could be very easy to generalize about working class capacities and political consciousness on the basis of fairly bureaucratic leaderships of, say, the AFL-CIO in the U.S. But interestingly, of course, when we do look at the base of the movement, this was a period of a rising wave of wildcat strikes, that is to say, unauthorized strikes, where workers were simply walking out, protesting conditions of work, tyrannical management, and so on. And arguably, nowhere was this truer, of course, than in the then heartland of the automobile industry, Detroit, where we had rank-and-file worker of color opposition groups like the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement. That was connected to the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, arguably one of the most workplace-oriented of the Black Power movements of the time. And we know from looking at hospitals and post offices and government offices and so on that there was a kind of political ferment happening, that young workers in particular workers of color, women workers, were affected by anti-war, anti-racist, feminist movements, and so on, and that many of those radical ideas were being expressed in workplace-based actions as well. So I think it's true that we often have a caricature of what the working class, even in a heartland of advanced industrial capitalism like the United States, was about. And it's very easy, unless you have a kind of ability to look at that grassroots rank and file level, that it's very, very easy to underestimate just the political and social ferment and the radicalism that was happening there. And of course, the United States wasn't unique. This was, if anything, even more the case in countries like Italy and France, where we had massive worker insurgencies in the same period, but again, often bringing them into conflict with their much more conservative union bureaucracies.
David McNally is my guest. He's a political economist, author of many books. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. A moment of profound shift took place in the 70s. So preceding that, there had been decades of growth and expansion of the working class affluence that extended to the working class, especially the white working class. Obviously, the working class was very racially, was and is very racially divided in the United States. And then in the 1970s, a crisis, global crisis of capitalism, and then the imposition of this new neoliberal order, this new way of structuring the economy, of transforming the way people lived and worked. You've started to touch on it, but I wonder if you can talk more about how neoliberalism, the process of neoliberalism, which is often framed as class war from above, but actually is also a bit more complex than that in terms of how it transforms people's relationships with each other, how that transformed the working class. And you used the word decomposition. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that, and I'm borrowing a phrase from some Italian radicals here, even if I'm using it with my own sort of inflections, but what I mean by that is that every working class movement creates certain institutional forms, cultural identities, including the music that informs the movement. It builds what Alan Sears has called infrastructures of dissent, by which he means the actual places where working class activists get together, meet, converse, debate, discuss, educate one another, generalize solidarity. And this can be everything from the union halls and union picnics of a certain era to the actual meetings in the bar around the corner from the workplace where you plan a walkout for the next day or the next week. But neoliberalism managed this multi-leveled assault. It's true, of course, it needed to use state power. Ronald Reagan needed it in the early 1980s to break the air traffic controller strike, and that was sort of the signal moment for a broad-based offensive. Margaret Thatcher used it in Britain in the mid-1980s to break the coal miners' union, which had been since 1926 the leading militant left-wing union in Great Britain. If we look at Bolivia, it was the crushing of the tin miners' union in the middle of the 1980s, which was the key to neoliberal transformations there. So absolutely, the state is crucial, particularly in its willingness, its drive to use state power to break very often extremely strong militant sections of the working class. In Canada, the most left-wing union in this period was the Postal Workers Union, and they were criminalized by having their strike made illegal and their president thrown in jail, and none of the rest of the labor movement did anything in response. And so you see all these moments within neoliberalism of direct state confrontation with important working class organizations and strikes. So that opens the door. But at a much more molecular level, employers, corporations are developing strategies to break organization within the workplace. And in particular, this meant beginning to contract out all kinds of work that had previously been done in-house. So General Motors starts to contract out the making of engines and wiper blades and so on to non-union small contractors. Then they start to relocate plants from the much more unionized North and Midwest of the U.S. into the much more non-union South or outside of the U.S., particularly into Mexico, over time. So they literally physically break down those places where workers used to gather with some collective agency, and a collective agency which bridged into the community, whether it was the union halls or other kinds of social institutions where working class people gathered, where people told the stories of the strikes that won the union, where there was a kind of culture of opposition which was sustained over the years, and everyone who went into the plants went in knowing the stories of the past battles that got them the union. They went in with a kind of rudimentary class consciousness. Well, when those communities start to disperse, when Detroit becomes what it is and Flint, Michigan becomes what it is, and then you go through Gary, Indiana, and parts of Illinois and so on and so forth, where older working class communities, which had been highly unionized, are essentially dispersed, you don't only lose the jobs, you also lose those infrastructures of dissent, and you lose the transmission belts for working class memory. That's an enormous cultural and political setback. And it means that when we talk about a reemergence of working class politics and working class struggle, we need to recognize that we cannot simply use the old coordinates. The left is too often using a compass that in a historical sense is 40 or 50 years old and sometimes more, rather than recognizing that a new wave of working class radicalization cannot take the old forms because the old institutions are gone. The old organizing centers are gone. And that needn't be a cause of despair, because historically what we've seen is these immense cycles in which working classes get very, very well organized, put immense pressure on capital. But the problem is either their agenda for social transformation is going to prevail, or you enter maybe a long period of what seems to be a social compromise, for instance, the so-called welfare state period after the Second World War, where basic union rights and protections were there for a significant section of the working class. But sooner or later, because of the rhythms of the capitalist economy, which is to say because capital is going to run into its recurrent profitability problems and crises, eventually they're going to go after those protections. And either the workers are able to resist or they become defeated, as they were in the 1970s in the neoliberal era. And well, that 1970s wave of defeats, of course, carries all through the 80s and often well through the 1990s also. And so that's where the concept of recomposition comes in. Any new mass working class movement is going to have new forms, new infrastructures of dissent, new sensibilities, new cultural forms, including music. You know, I hate to say it to some of the old timers, but it probably won't be Pete Seeger who will represent the kind of music of a new generation of radicalizing young workers today. All of this will change. And that shouldn't surprise us. Nor should we necessarily assume that it will take the form of workplace based labor organizations always. It may or it may not. In Marx's day, if you joined the union, it wasn't based in your workplace. It was based in your community. It was a citywide, sometimes national, union structure that you were joining. And it didn't have workplace branches, and it didn't have collective agreements, but it was a political organization of workers. And so when I think today, for instance, about the Fight for 15 campaign, we're a real mass struggle against low-wage work and precarious work to take off in the United States or Canada or what have you, it's going to need a new organizational form that's much broader than the historic workplace-based collective bargaining unions. I hope it's connected to those as well, but it's going to need to be something much broader. And that's one of the challenges, I think, for Marxism and for the left today, to have that capacity to think about new terrains of struggle, new coordinates of resistance, and what kinds of forms might be starting to emerge today that will speak to a politics of left and working class recomposition coming out of the cycle of decomposition across the neoliberal era.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lillian, and I'm speaking with David McNally. He's an activist and professor of political science at York University in Toronto, author of many books, including most recently Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism. And today we're talking about the struggles of the working class, the ebbing and flowing of movements to take on capitalism. And one thing that you spoke about, David, when you're talking about the ways that we need to find new ways of organizing, not be locked into the old forms and new ways of coming together, I wondered if you could talk a little more. You did touch on this, but in talking about how neoliberalism has created obstacles in doing this, the role it's played in the decomposition of the working class. You were talking about both things that happened at the point of production and then these things that happen outside of them, such as union halls. But I wonder if you can talk about the kind of broader role of daily life under neoliberalism, which, you know, can include resting, reading, having children, looking after them, trying to keep yourself, you know, healthy so that you can keep going back to work, and all of these things. How has neoliberalism affected that, and how has that affected the ability, heretofore anyway, of people to come together collectively?
I think this is a huge issue, and one that intuitively a lot of us recognize, but which we have not theorized very well. What I mean by that is that we're all aware of how stressful daily life has become, of how people feel that they're constantly sacrificing sleep, the time with their loved ones, with people who matter most to them in their lives, because the constant speed up of everyday life, of which the speed up of work life is part, but not the whole story. And that's got to do with the privatization of all kinds of things that in robust or more robust welfare states, people could often take for granted. And what I mean by that is the scramble for childcare, for instance, the scramble to look after elderly or ailing parents or relatives. All of these things that we think ought to have robust social services have, of course, been increasingly frayed. And so, yes, there's speed up of our lives in the workplace, and yes, often for those of us whose work involves computerization, work is often invading our home lives as well, where we're doing emails for hours after dinner and that sort of thing. But similarly, care for children, care for the elderly, care for sick and ailing friends and partners, all of that is stretching people enormously thin. And that is a real challenge to the ways in which we think about organizing today. Having said that, it's really important to remind ourselves that just last weekend with the January 21st women's marches against Trump, we saw that the capacity for mass mobilization is still there. So that's not the issue. But there is an issue around sustained organization that I'll come back to. But equally challenging, of course, is the fragmentation and atomization that neoliberalism brings. One of the things I like to always remind people of is that most people don't come to radical politics out of being theoretically convinced. They come through a much messier process, which has a pragmatic foundation, by which I mean they are discovering that certain ways of affecting their world don't work, are dead ends, and others seem to offer more hope and more possibility. But of course, if collective forms of organizing and resistance are less and less effective, and that's one of the things which happened with the decline and retreat of unions, then people are thrown back on individualized solutions. If you don't have a union, or if your union, in fact, keeps buckling to the employer and offering up concession contracts, and you're trying to figure out what you're doing about your children's future, then you've got to look elsewhere. The strategies then start to become highly individualized. And that was happening alongside an ever-increased financialization of everyday life that neoliberalism brought with it. One of the things about neoliberalism is that financial markets got deeply extended into working-class people's lives. Working-class people began to carry more forms of debt than they traditionally historically had, and this included even poorer sections of the working class who had often historically been, particularly if they were racialized, locked out of capacity to borrow from banks and get mortgages and that sort of thing. But then the more you get caught up in these sorts of institutions, the more you're pressured to address as an individual your financial situation, rather than to think about these problems collectively. Now, I don't want to overgeneralize that because I think there's a limit. I think in a new wave of growing social resistance, we are going to see debt repudiation kinds of movements, particularly, I think, around student debt. I expect that debt may become a site of collective resistance and organizing in the years ahead. But when that's not on offer, it's your individual problem, and it's deeply stressful, and people are constantly trying to figure out how to borrow from X to pay Y. All of that is part of that fragmentation and atomization, and it would be, I think, very naive for any left movements to underestimate those. What it does mean, I think, is that we need to learn to speak about those. We need to understand that what some commentators have called financial expropriation, that is to say the interest payments that working class households are paying to banks, can become, for many workers, at least equally important to exploitation at work. And so their relationship to financial institutions is going to be a big, big issue, particularly where government is backing those institutions and intervening in them. I think the calls to socialize the financial sector, to bring it into public hands, and all those sorts of issues will be on the agenda in the years ahead, as well as debt repudiation. But coming back to what I said earlier, the fact that the terrain of everyday life has changed is really important for how we think about organizing. We're going to need to think, I believe, about a return to more community-based models. That is to say, not the idea that either workers are going to be able to stay after work somewhere and meet for several hours when they've got to go pick up children, care for elderly folks and so on. We're going to have to branch out into communities. That is, I think, a real prospect for some of these movements. That is to say that they can get community-based, and certainly I can only speak about what Fight for 15 is doing in the city where I live, Toronto, but that more community-based focus is exactly what it's bringing at the moment. But we're going to have to go a lot more to where people are. And interestingly, I believe that some working-class movements, particularly in places like Bolivia, began to think in these terms in the early 2000s, where they stopped assuming that people would just automatically gravitate to their centers, and they actually went out and found new ways to connect to people at transportation hubs while people are waiting for buses and subways, to distribute leaflets, talk to people, and so on. So there will be new models of organizing, and it's going to have to be very experimental. People are going to, you know, capitalists always use the term best practices. They need to figure out what the best ways are of making workplaces more capitalistically efficient. Well, I think the left needs to think about best practices. What's working in terms of mass-based organizing in communities around workplace-based issues and so on, and how do we generalize from that? How do we learn from that? So new models are very much going to be on the agenda.
Political economist David McNally is my guest. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You mentioned a while back that the problem, contrary in some ways to the historical memory about even fairly recent movements, the problem is not actually mobilizing people, that the problem is sustaining movements in some more long-term way. One can just think of the mass marches that happened in 2003 against the impending invasion of Iraq. Millions of people came out into the streets in 2006. There were the immigrant worker strikes. Obviously, Occupy was another example of people coming out in a mass way, but it wasn't sustained. Do you think this conundrum for the left of mobilization versus sustained organization is partially the product of neoliberalism, and or is it something about how we just really haven't hit on the right form, or some combination of the two? How do you understand it?
I think it's something of both. I think one of the things that's really interesting and sometimes incredibly exciting about the forms of social protest that we've been seeing, particularly since the 2008-09 financial crisis, is that they have this capacity to massively seize public space. And there is an electricity when they do that. There is a sense of breaking down certain kinds of social apartheids and reclaiming public space, reclaiming the streets, reclaiming parks and city squares. Everybody senses in some way that urban space has been gentrified and corporatized, that poor and working class people and young people have been driven out of those spaces, in part just because they're often in financial sectors that people cannot afford to regularly patronize and so on. And so when you get these semi-insurgent movements that seize a park by Wall Street or seize Tahrir Square in Cairo or Gezi Taksim Square in Istanbul or whatever it might be, the great mobilizations in Madrid by young people in the early stages of the crisis and so on. Those encampments and the like are electrifying. I think they have a huge purpose in that in reclaiming public space, they can become a site for certain kinds of oppositional energies and education and mobilization. But their inherent limit is what we were just talking about. People have to somehow get through everyday life, notwithstanding the fact that all the excitement is in a square somewhere or in a park. And what those movements have not been successful at doing is linking the very local to these centers of resistance and mobilization. And there's no question, as Occupy was declining, there were clearly discussions about that sort of work happening in a lot of areas. People thinking that campaigns for racial justice, Fight for 15, and so on could get dug in at local levels. And I think in some areas people did commendable work there. But I think the really difficult problem is that we don't really have the organizational practices yet to be able to link the local with the large scale. It is a problem of different scales and how they interconnect. So we either have really interesting local groups which have no capacity right now or very little capacity to project onto a larger political stage. As a result, they fly under the radar too often, and they're not affecting the wider political culture, even if they're doing great work in a community. Or we have the very large and short-lived mobilizations, which briefly seize public attention and quickly start to redefine narratives as to what's happening in the society, but tend not to be sustained. And these problems of scale, which is to say, okay, what kinds of organizations with, if I can put it in these terms, intermediate level kinds of structures can we create? In other words, if we're building Fight for 15 or Black Lives Matter organizations in the following communities, how do we then project on a citywide scale? How then do the citywide organizations link up by sending delegates, for instance, to weekly or monthly meetings on larger scales, so that there's a constant transmission from one scale to another, not just, say, from the local to the citywide to the statewide and beyond, but in the other direction as well?
Well, what you're talking about speaks to the desired breadth of movements, and which leads me to ask you, do you think that in building movements to oppose capitalism, that it's the working class, kind of returning to the beginning of this program, that should be the umbrella into which movements take place? And out of that question, I should ask you, how do you define the working class? Is it something that we should define in kind of narrow terms or very broad terms that would then allow for that kind of extra capacity? And if you mean the larger, how do we deal with the fact that we're talking about populations that are very divided from one another along racial and other lines?
Yes. And I don't think there's any easy answer to this question. I would say that I think long term, we are talking about the building of movements which do have a kind of class identity and class consciousness, but that this has to be by definition a sort of unity of the diverse. That is to say, it has to be, there's no way you can have a meaningful working class movement today which isn't feminist, which isn't anti-racist, which isn't queer positive, which isn't ecological in orientation. So that we have to, I think, challenge the idea that a class-based movement means a movement of that minority of workers who have trade unions, for instance. Trade unions can, and I hope will, be a significant part of broader working class movements. But working classes are not reducible to the organizations that may or may not be collectively grouping people together around workplace issues. So when, for me, the working class is all of those people who are reliant on their ability or the ability of those with whom they live to find wages. And they can be unemployed. They can be partly employed. They can be seeking wage labor. They can be moving in and out of combinations of working for a wage and doing other little kinds of so-called independent contract type work. But those who don't have the capacity to live off their investments, have the capacity to live off property.
And so that would include also people who often identify as middle class, well-paid professionals.
It would. For me, there's no question that even if you are a relatively well-paid teacher, you still rely on your ability to sell your capacity as a teacher to some employer, be it a school board or a private school or what have you. And if you're not living off property, if you're living off the work you do, then to me that means you're working class. And it doesn't mean that you're in industrial work necessarily. The majority of workers today, in my definition, are in what we loosely call the service sector, even though I have lots of quibbles with that, because when I walk into a McDonald's, it sure looks like an assembly line that's producing the Big Mac to me when I see how it's being done, even though it's being called service work for all kinds of reasons that are unique to economists and government statisticians and the like. So, yes, I see the vast majority as working class, but there's no way in my mind that there can be a meaningful working class movement today, meaningful, by which I mean a mass working class movement, which, as I say, isn't a racial justice movement and isn't a feminist movement and isn't a pro-queer movement and so on. We have to recognize that there have never been working class movements that somehow had an uncomplicated working class identity without other social oppressions being a significant part of how class is experienced in our society. To be a black woman worker in our society is intrinsic to every one of those dimensions is intrinsic to what it means to be working class, because you're a racialized worker, because you're a gendered worker, and you suffer distinct kinds of gendered oppression within our society.
Well, let me end with this question, although I'm not trying to have you be an oracle here, David, but I do wonder if you feel like the Trump presidency and the already mobilizing opposition to it has the capacity to lead to some kind of wider anti-capitalist politics, or because it's focusing on a Republican, is it likely to be locked into a sort of politics that keeps wishing for the Democrats to come back, to have them be the voice of sanity here? How do you think this all could go?
Starting with your first question, I definitely think it has the capacity to move in an anti-capitalist direction. But I don't think there are any guarantees in that regard. And I think anybody who's honest with themselves has to acknowledge that there is a dominant form of politics, which is a kind of liberal incorporation of whole layers of social protest movements into the apparatus of neoliberalism in a way that de-radicalizes them. And at the same time, I think that incorporation is more likely to be challenged today for all kinds of reasons. One of the reasons I think that it's more likely to be challenged is the fact of austerity capitalism that we've been living through since the crisis of 2008-09. I see no evidence that capitalism is in a position to return to robust, sustained growth rates. I think it's going to continue in the sort of form we've seen in recent years, which is to say, at best, growth rates that keep up with population growth, And much of the time, growth rates, particularly what we're seeing in most of Europe at the moment, which don't even keep up with that, so that unemployment levels, real unemployment levels, remain high, and that the quality of work continues to deteriorate. It is more casual, more part-time, more precarious, low-wage work. And in that circumstance, in those conditions, it's more difficult to sell, just follow the great neoliberal messiahs. I think that's a key to understanding Trump's election. That is to say, the failure of the neoliberal elites of the Democratic Party to be able to rally enthusiasm behind Hillary Clinton. I think that does speak to a disaffection and a disengagement from that kind of neoliberal politics. And so that's the hope, if you will, that these movements, or at least a significant layer of these movements, could begin to crystallize in another direction. The other thing I would add is that it's very clear from all kinds of work that pretty serious sociologists have done that there is a younger generation, really globally, that has not been shaped by Cold War mentalities, who had no problem, for example, coming back to the Sanders campaign, which I mentioned earlier, no problem politically identifying themselves with a politician who declared himself socialist. Now, we can discuss the limits of Bernie's so-called socialism another time. What matters to me is that the Cold War scare meant so little to a younger generation of people coming into politics. We continue to see this very favorable idea of socialism registering in an awful lot of polls. What that means, it seems to me, is that a non-sectarian socialist left really was organizing around the issues of the day, speaking in thoughtful and creative ways to how we move movements forward, ought to be able to begin to become at least a meaningful minority pole of attraction. That's going to raise all kinds of challenges. What kind of organizing do you do to keep that moving forward? And I won't pretend for a moment to have the answers to that. But I think what it says is that this is a really interesting moment of challenge for very broad forces on the left, because there's no doubt there is a dominant pattern out there, and that dominant pattern will be for the political energies not to find an outlet, for a kind of decline after the big events that means that organizations don't come out stronger, that anti-capitalist currents and movements don't come out stronger, and the default reaction will always be, therefore, the Democrats as the alternative. And I think that's out there as a danger, unquestionably. What I think a lot of people know that right now. I think, ironically, one of the things that's going to be difficult for the Democrats in their politics of incorporation is that Trump means business. I don't think this stuff is rhetorical. I think we're talking about an intensified neoliberal offensive where they want to go after so many historical gains of the working class and the social movements around voting rights, reproductive rights, around the environment, around indigenous rights, around policing and racial justice. I think they want to go after so many different sections of oppressed and working class people in this society that there are going to be ongoing fightbacks and resistance. I think it's going to be hard for neoliberal elites like the Democrats to incorporate those people. But the problem is, if serious forces of the left don't rise to the occasion and have a kind of multi-year perspective, not the idea that next week is the key, but that we're rebuilding a left over the next decade, then if we can't rise to that occasion, then for sure someone else will fill the vacuum, even if it's rhetorically. But I think there are openings. I think there are possibilities that are genuine, even if there are no guarantees.
I've been speaking with political economist David McNally, author of many books, including most recently Monsters of the Market. David, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure, as always, Sasha.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.